Sir Giles Yeo, next Monday to Friday lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio. This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday the 6th of February. Good morning, this is Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. Senior officials from the US and Iran are due to hold talks today about Tehran's nuclear programme, with Donald Trump's threat of military action looming over the meeting. We'll be hearing from a former senior White House advisor to President Trump on Gulf security.
The US team can't leave these talks without addressing all of the files they came in to talk about. They can't make it just a nuclear discussion, even though Iran keeps trying to frame it as such.
And a major review of statins suggests that the cholesterol-reducing drugs are far safer than previously thought.
And also in today's programme, the renowned artist Andy Goldsworthy, who creates his work from natural materials found in the landscape, tells us why he's happy to be an outsider in every sense.
Nature as a subject matter was kind of not seen as the right thing for art to be engaging with. Now, obviously, it's changed. It's the only subject.
And he's back.
Who is this creature with terrible claws and terrible teeth in his terrible jaws? He has knobbly knees and turned-out toes and a poisonous wart at the end of his nose.
20 years after the Gruffalo's last outing, the great Julia Donaldson and Axel Scheffler will be joining us to tell us what he's getting up to now. The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Talks between the United States and Iran are due to take place in Oman this morning as Washington seeks to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Trump has repeatedly threatened Iran with military action if there's no diplomatic solution. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Caroline Hawley.
It's taken days of difficult and delicate diplomacy to get this to happen at all. There was wrangling over the venue and format of the talks, let alone the substance. They're the first between the US and Iran since last June, before American fighter jets joined Israel in bombing the country's nuclear facilities. And they come after Donald Trump ordered a significant military build-up in the Middle East, following Iran's crackdown on protests last month, when thousands of people were killed. The stakes are high not just for Iran, but the whole region, with several Middle Eastern countries involved in trying to calm tensions and avoid a new war. But distrust between the two sides is huge, as are the differences between them.
Ministers, officials and advisers will be forced to hand over electronic communications exchanged with Lord Mandelson, such as WhatsApp messages and emails, as part of the disclosure of evidence relating to his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the United States. Downing Street had hoped to control the process, but was forced to change its plans in the face of anger from Labour MPs. Sir Keir Starmer is under pressure after acknowledging he'd known Lord Mandelson had continued to be friends with Jeffrey Epstein, even after the American financier had been convicted of sex offences. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Number 10 will be relieved that only a handful of backbenchers have publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. But the underlying anger among Labour MPs towards Sir Keir Starmer is still palpable. He's promised to release files related to Lord Mandelson's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US in December 2024. Any documents the government deems potentially unfit for the public eye will go to Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee for further scrutiny. That committee has said it expects the government to provide all documents within scope of that process, which would include personal exchanges between government figures and Peter Mandelson, stretching back to Labour's election victory.
A review of statins suggests they're far safer than previously thought. The study, reported in The Lancet, found the cholesterol-lowering drugs did not cause most of the possible side effects listed inside the packs. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
Up to 8 million people in the UK take statins. The cheap daily pills can lower bad cholesterol levels to cut the risk of heart attacks and strokes. Like with any medication, there can be side effects. 66 are listed on leaflets in packs, but experts who carried out the study involving more than 120,000 people found only a few rare ones, such as muscle problems. Statins were not to blame for ailments like memory loss, depression, disturbed sleep, weight gain, or impotence. The researchers say the leaflets should be changed to reflect this and avoid scaring people off using the life-saving medicine.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has become the latest African country to agree to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants after the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, threatened to impose visa restrictions on people travelling to the UK. Angola and Namibia agreed in December to take back their citizens. Amelia Clark reports.
In late December, the Home Secretary imposed visa restrictions on people entering the UK from the Democratic Republic of Congo after its government refused to allow the return of illegal migrants and offenders. Shabana Mahmood said fast-track visas would no longer apply to people from the DRC, while VIPs and politicians would no longer get preferential treatment as long as it failed to cooperate. Angola and Namibia, two other African nations threatened with visa bans, agreed to the measures just before the new year. More than 3,000 illegal migrants from Angola, Namibia and the DRC could be removed. It's understood that India, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Somalia and Gabon are all resistant to similar returns deals. It's possible that the government could look at sanctions for those countries.
A teacher who was attacked at a school in Pembrokeshire yesterday has been discharged from hospital. A 15-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder after the incident at Milford Haven Comprehensive School. Police say he's still in custody. A number of people have told the BBC they face growing debt after inheriting retirement flats they can't sell. They say restrictive leases and high running costs are putting off potential buyers. Gordon Taylor's mother died in 2024 and her flat has been empty ever since. He's having to pay £11,000 a year in service charges, ground rent and council tax.
She probably thought she was leaving something to her offspring, only to find that it's actually become a millstone. Massive issue. It's a national issue. The system in this sector is obviously broken.
The Retirement Housing Group, which represents the sector, disputes the figures and says 95% of such properties are occupied. The Winter Olympics will formally open this evening in Italy. There'll be two ceremonies in Milan and the town of Cortina d'Ampezzo in the Dolomites. The Games will take place across both locations, as well as in Livigno in the Italian Alps, from where our correspondent Andy Swiss reports.
For the first time in Olympic history, the opening ceremony is being shared across two locations. The main event in Milan will feature performances from Mariah Carey and Andrea Bocelli, but at the same time there'll be another ceremony and another Olympic cauldron in the mountains in Cortina, reflecting the geographical spread of these games across northern Italy. For Team GB, who won just two medals at the last Winter Olympics in Beijing, there are high hopes. They have a number of current world champions, including skier Zoe Atkin and Matt Weston in the skeleton.
Andy Swiss reporting.
Thank you. Let's get the weather then. It's 7 minutes past six. Helen Willits is here. Morning.
Good morning, Anna. I have more of the same for you with low pressure sat to the southwest of the UK. We've got various weather fronts circulating that low pressure, which means they're slow moving across the UK, but bringing more unneeded rainfall, unwelcome really, because the ground is so saturated. Numerous flood warnings still in force and a couple of Met Office warnings for the rain as well. Across parts of West Midlands, East Wales and Southern England. So I'll start with England and Wales because although it's slightly less windy than yesterday, there's still quite a keen wind pushing this rain in and northwards. There's less issue with snow as we go forward with time because the air is slightly milder than yesterday and there's a better chance for Southern England and the South of Wales to see something a bit brighter with even a few glimmers of sunshine today. But that's behind the main rain and it comes with heavy showers, even the odd rumble of thunder. But it is slightly milder, 9 to 12 for these areas. Where we've got the rain, more likely 7 to 9 degrees Celsius. That rain just keeps coming through the day. Northern Ireland, similarly so. We've got strong to gale force winds here, blowing outbreaks of rain heavy at times, on and off through much of the day as well. Here, temperatures probably as yesterday, 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. For Scotland, we do have some slightly chillier air still in force or in place here, and some brighter weather as well, as yesterday, across Skye, the Western Isles, the northwest coast as well. And temperatures might reach 7 or 8 degrees, but there's quite a bit of cloud further east and some outbreaks of rain, snow for the hills, so more like 2 or 3 degrees.
Hmm. Thank you, Helen. 9 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers. The Mail believes that the former Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner is eyeing Sir Keir Starmer's job. "I'm ready to go," is its headline, reflecting what she's said to have told one Labour MP as the Prime Minister, in the paper's words, fights for his political life. The Telegraph reports that some MPs, including allies of the former Deputy Prime Minister, believe she may be unable to stand while she awaits the outcome of an HMRC inquiry into her failure to pay a £40,000 stamp duty bill on a flat.
The Daily Mirror says there is a clear and present danger to the Prime Minister's tenure because of Lord Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. According to The Eye, Labour MPs are wargaming how to get rid of Sir Keir. The paper says they're considering sending a delegation of senior female MPs to Downing Street to tell him to stand down, as Tory men in grey suits once told Margaret Thatcher to go back in 1990.
The Times reports that Sir Keir Starmer, his ministers and advisers will be forced to disclose all communication with Lord Mandelson before and after his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. The disclosure is expected to be the biggest release of previously confidential government documents since the COVID inquiry. Paper says the release has the potential to be politically explosive.
Daily Statins safe for millions more to take, declares the main headline in the Daily Express today. The paper says a landmark study has found incontrovertible evidence that the drugs are not behind conditions like memory loss, dementia and depression. Writing in the Express, Professor Brian Williams of the British Heart Foundation says there's absolutely no doubt that statins save lives. The paper's editorial says that while medicines play a crucial role for many, getting active is the prescription they need. We'll bring you a little more on that story later this hour.
And The Sun reports that 16-year-old Kai Rooney is following in the footsteps of his father, Wayne Rooney, by being offered a new deal by Manchester United. The paper says the contract is a one-year scholarship, which could then switch to a three-year professional deal worth £50,000 a year.
It's 11 minutes past six now. President Trump says a military strike on Iran is not off the table, even as talks begin between the two sides on trying to agree a new nuclear deal. He's also now given his approval to the UK deal to hand the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, which you'll remember he criticised just a couple of weeks ago. Well, our correspondent Helena Humphrey spoke to me earlier and started by telling me what the president has been saying in the run-up to those Iran negotiations.
Well, a range of comments. Overall, the stance from Washington has been we're open to diplomacy, but military action is not off the table. And you have these kind of oscillating comments. So there was the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., and President Trump said that, yes, negotiations are underway on a nuclear deal. But at the same time, he was asked by NBC News whether the supreme leader should be worried. And he said, yes, he should be very worried. And he's previously said time is running out. And then, of course, you've got the optics of all of this and the build-up of US military assets in the Middle East that we have seen. And I think questions as well about whether both sides are on the same page in terms of what they're talking about. Is this just about the nuclear program? Is this about support for proxy groups in the region? Iran has simply said that this is about the nuclear program. But if we look at past his prologue here, President Trump has previously carried out an airstrike in June of last year, Operation Midnight Hammer. So I think it's fair to say the pressure is certainly on.
And speaking of the president's changing positions, he was also talking about the UK's deal on the Chagos Islands as well, which, having said it was a terrible idea a couple of weeks ago, he's now on board with.
Yes, he's made another turnaround, saying that this is the best deal that the Prime Minister could make. He caveated this by saying that if anyone threatens the US operations at the US base, he reserves the right to use military force to secure it, which perhaps isn't an unusual position from Washington. But I think what we saw was this big scramble, phone calls between the US President and Sir Keir Starmer, reports of extra security guarantees. But I think the main change of heart here was perhaps that negotiating tactic. Donald Trump had said that this was all about national security in the same way that the US ownership of Greenland was. And then we saw that softening of stance there following conversations with the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte at the World Economic Forum. So I think overall, when it comes to the special relationship, the idea that it's patched up for now, but with the understanding Donald Trump's positions can and often change quickly.
Helena Humphrey in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
14 minutes past six. Families across England have been telling the BBC about what some call a never-ending nightmare. It's about the inheritance of retirement flats. Let's talk to Angus Crawford, the correspondent, who has uncovered this. Angus, these people have received something that you would think has value, and they presumably would think has value, but actually turns out to be anything but.
Absolutely. Some have described what they inherited as not a boon, but a millstone or a noose around their necks. Why? Well, imagine your elderly mother or father buys a flat in an age-restricted block. That's for over 60s or over 70s. Sadly, they die. The flat is then empty. You try to sell it, but then you find no one wants to buy it. And at that stage, you are still liable, and the estate is, to buy service charges, council tax, ground rent, and that could be up to something like £11,000 a year. And I've found flats which are staying empty for as long as 9 years, and some families say they just want to give them away.
God. And does the industry accept that it has a problem?
Well, the thing is, it's really interesting. Why aren't they selling? I mean, the critics of the situation say it's about high service charges, which have gone up a lot in the last 10 years, leases that are restrictive and only certain age groups can go there. And there's an oversupply now of these kinds of flats. Well, as you say, the industry trade body, well, first of all, it disputes this situation. It also says the numbers which I found out, which are approximately 10,000 across England and Wales, aren't disproportionately high. That's what they say. They say the sector also isn't immune to general housing market downturns, and operators have measures to support people during resales, but that still leaves hundreds, possibly thousands of families across England and Wales waiting to sell their flat and still paying the bills.
Angus Crawford, thank you.
It is 6:15 now. Let's turn to business, and the on-again, off-again merger between two of the world's biggest mining companies is this morning officially off. Will Bain is here with more on that and the rest of the business news. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Justin. Yes, well, we think so this time for sure. Rio Tinto and Glencore had a sort of make or break day yesterday, and looks like they have abandoned plans for a $260 billion merger. George Cheveley is with us. George is the portfolio manager for metals and mining specialist at the global investment manager 91. George, morning.
Morning, Will.
Is this it then, do you think?
It certainly is for the moment, yeah. I mean, they can't come back straight away. It's a bit of a shock. It seemed to make sense, this deal, but they couldn't meet on price, it seems.
Yeah, they both seem to be blaming each other for the sort of collapse of this.
Well, you know, one didn't want to pay so much, one didn't want to receive that amount. I think whatever the statement said, it came down to the value in the end that both saw on each side of the deal.
Yeah, why did you think it made sense to you to see the two together?
Well, there was a pretty good fit on the asset side. Rio have short-term copper growth, but less long-term. Glencore had a pretty strong pipeline of copper projects sort of to develop over the next sort of 10, 15 years. And so there was quite a good fit there between the cultures. There was also, you know, potential for Glencore's marketing expertise to be applied to Rio's, you know, huge iron ore sales and you know, other opportunities within that portfolio as well.
Is that what's shifted this a little bit as well? Copper, the US adding it to its list of so-called rare earths, critical earths recently as well, and that we've seen the price climbing pretty rapidly in the past couple of years as well, over, you know, its use in everything, a kind of energy transition to the changing kind of world of AI and all that kind of stuff as well.
No, certainly the need to, you know, grow in the copper space was why Rio were looking at this. And Glencore offered a very good opportunity to do that. I think in terms of the deal not happening, in some ways, copper wasn't the problem. I think to some extent, we've seen iron ore prices flatten. Coal prices have actually started to pick up, where Glencore's quite big. And one wonders whether, you know, they were looking at that and saying, well, maybe, you know, things are going to improve on our side over the next few months, years.
And so what do you see going forward here then as being, why don't you take them in turn, strategies, outlooks?
Yeah, I mean, look at the base of this as well. Both companies are in good shape. And in some ways, that's another problem with the deal. Neither needed to do this. I think Rio clearly have growth opportunities, certainly over the next 5 years. I think they need to, you know, they obviously want to add more copper inorganically as a quicker way to do that. But they will, you know, assess that. I think in Glencore's side, they did a deal earlier this week where they sold a minority stake in their mines in DRC. PRC to a private equity group, maybe that also, you know, made them think, well, we can realise quite a lot of value from our portfolio. And I think we will see Glencore continue to tidy up its portfolio and release some cash to develop their copper projects.
Yeah. George, thanks so much for your time this morning. George Sheevely there, Portfolio Manager, Metals and Mining Specialist at the Global Investment Manager 91. Well, here in the studio with us this morning is Mary-Therese Barton, Equity Partner and Chief Investment Officer for Fixed Income at Pictet Asset Management. Morning.
Morning, Will.
Should we start with Amazon, which has kind of rounded up a week of jitters, would it be fair to say, from investors about big tech in particular, how much cash they're spending on AI?
Certainly jitters. I mean, the route we've seen in stock markets is more similar to what we saw in DeepSeek 1 year ago, you know, this big shock on AI developments in China. So, yeah, it's definitely been a bit of a rupture and a bit of a wake-up call as well in terms of, are these investments in AI going to come good?
Was it the sheer scale of what Amazon said it was going to plough into AI, but data centres very specifically as well?
$200 billion, one third higher than forecasts. And actually, if you take four of the biggest US tech companies, $650 billion in capital expenditure. It's going to be of a scale we haven't seen in our lifetimes. And indeed, you probably have to go back to the US railroads before you see that scale of investment.
And a lot of this kind of sparked by this company Anthropic, another big US tech company, and what it's doing in AI. And it's talking about rolling out yet another product. So it looks like some of this turmoil might roll into next week as well. Certainly thrown down the challenge.
Indeed. But, you know, it's an environment where valuations have been tight. There was almost indiscriminate optimism. So now there's a real sense of trying to get under the hood, who the winners are going to be, who the losers are going to be, what it's going to mean for different sectors. And it's just challenging the orthodoxy that we've had for over a year in terms of this AI narrative.
Yeah, interesting. Closer to home and closer to your world, fixed income, bonds.
Yes.
What was the bond market's reaction to what Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, had to say yesterday after holding those interest rates?
Well, expecting interest rates to come lower, with growth and inflation being revised down, and with actually that vote being a lot closer on being on hold than we expected, with actually two members of the MPC actually voting for a cut, we think we could be seeing a further interest rate cut in March and then a further one after that as well, with a terminal rate of around 3%. So bond markets like it on the front end of a curve. But, you know, I think what we need to be thinking a little bit more is about what's happening with the political volatility, about the fiscal, the narrative that's developing in UK politics, and what that means for what we call the steepness of the curve, i.e. how much risk premium for lending the UK government money, where does that need to be? And I think that needs to be higher.
Right, so explain that through. So Andrew Bailey talking about stability and this neutral rate and really kind of giving the sort of groundwork of where a kind of state, where he thinks a stable interest rate might be for a couple of years ahead. And yet, everything that's going on with the Prime Minister and Lord Mandelson, that actually is driving the longer end of those, the bond yield, so the 10 or the 30 year.
Yeah, and those interest rates are moving higher. In fact, that shape of the curve
already
is the steepest it's been since 2018. Some maybe less polite people in the market would call it the moron premium for the UK, you know, since the Liz Truss moment that we had and the more political volatility. And in many ways, we've actually seen a Brexit moment in how our interest rates and our bonds are actually trading. They're trading more in line with the US. So we had a very different price action compared to some of our European markets over the last weeks.
And is it that investors just basically don't feel they can see the landscape for what tax and spend might look like? Is it as simple as that?
Yes, but it's also about policy credibility, and it's really having the confidence, A, the central bank's going to do what it says, and actually our fiscal accounts are under control.
Mary-Therese Barton, Equity Partner and Chief Investment Officer for Fixed Income at Pictet Asset Management. Thanks so much for your time. Well, would you trust a robot to manage the sale of your home? A company called Lawhive, an AI law firm here and also based in the US as well, have developed an operating system to apparently do exactly that and more. And Pierre Proner is the chief executive and co-founder of Lawhive and joins us this morning. Pierre, morning.
Good morning, Will.
How's this work then?
Well, you know, when we first started Lawhive back in 2020, we were just an AI software company. But by 2022, we sort of understood to have the kind of real meaningful impact on the consumer end of the legal space, we would need to be a law firm. So at that point, we became the world's first AI native law firm. What that means is we combine licensed regulated solicitors and lawyers with our own AI software that automates all of the routine legal and administrative work that those lawyers do.
Right, so which one leads which path, if you know what I mean? How much are the humans leading the AI? How much are the AI leading and the humans are sort of picking up those bits?
It's always human-led, and this is the key, you know, in our view, to providing sort of supervision and compliance over the way that AI makes decisions. And so it's, you know, the difference between proprietary AI software that we've built and, say, a commercial chatbot is it sort of forces the human to authorize the work, to supervise it. And of course, you know, as a regulated solicitor or lawyer, those lawyers have a professional, ethical, regulatory responsibility to ensure the quality of that work.
And from a nuts and bolts perspective, then, that's how you make the money from it, right? Is it software subscriptions?
It's based on legal fees of work done through our law firm. So in the same way that a traditional high street law firm charges for legal work, we do the same. We're an alternative to, you know, your local high street firm. We just are far more transparent in pricing, and the work is much more consistent because of the kinds of advantages that AI automation has in ensuring work quality and speed.
In terms of that transparency, then what's clients' attitudes been, and what have they asked to see and to know more about?
Yeah, the reception has been incredibly positive since we launched 2023, so much so that we've grown the team very significantly in the last couple of years. We've launched recently into the US as well. We cover right across the UK, everything from family law to property transactions, things like landlord-tenant disputes, even consumer rights. So anything that sort of everyday consumers across Britain, you know, face on a daily basis.
And so could obviously potentially better news for consumers in terms of speed and price and efficiency, as you said. What about for jobs, though? Presumably it means long term that you need fewer people.
We don't believe that. Actually, quite the opposite. You know, we're advantaged in that at this end of the market in consumer legal, that there are far more regular people who need access to good, high quality legal advice.
I never quite understand this bit, because people come on and say it'll be very efficient and we'll save loads of money, and then none of the people who are presumably the very expensive bit apparently are ever going to go. Are we underselling how many people will be impacted by this?
I think it depends on the industry. For us, you know, really it's the human lawyer through regulation, through ethical responsibility that ensures the caliber of the work, supervision, compliance with the work. AI, in this case, you could think of it as a graduate trainee in a law firm. Graduate trainees can do very, very good, you know, solid work, but they can also make mistakes. And so you need to supervise them. And it's the same for AI. So I think in this space, you know, through the model that we apply, which is a regulated law firm, human lawyers will always have a job. They'll just be able to help more clients.
And how much of an issue is that still? So-called hallucinations, AI sort of coming up with the wrong answer, still a little bit in this early phase of the tech.
Yeah, and it, you know, we take a sort of two-prong approach to that. Firstly, it's the lawyer's responsibility to ensure the caliber of the work. Again, you know, it's like working with the graduate trainee, you ensure the caliber of that work. But secondly, we've built our own software to have guardrails in place to ensure that there has to be human supervision, has to be oversight, very differentiated from a commercial chatbot that, you know, does not require that, and hallucination is more of a problem.
Pierre Prona, Chief Executive and co-founder of LawHive, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Well, thank you. 27 minutes past six. Some of us only managed one half of the rugby last night, early mornings and all the rest of it. But it was quite a half, even the first one, Mike.
Yes, it was indeed. At the start of the Six Nations, Justin, it was a chastening night for Ireland in Paris.
Jégu, lovely hands, Ramos, Mappy, that's brilliant. Jalapé, Atesogbi's in at the corner. Yes, he is. What a way for France to finish. What a statement to the rest of the Six Nations from Le Bleu.
Yes, holders France got the defence of their Six Nations campaign underway with an emphatic bonus point win over Ireland last night. They won 36-14 at the Stade de France. Here's Chris Jones.
France and Ireland have dominated the Six Nations of late, winning the past four titles between them, but on this evidence the teams are going in very different directions. For large parts of the game, France were rampant. They led 22-0 at half-time, scoring three sublime first-half tries. Louis Biel-Biarry added his second shortly into the second half as France moved 29 points clear. Ireland, to their credit, fought back. They scored 14 unanswered points and flirted with the impossible, but with the Stade de France crowd baying, Théo Atesogbe crossed at the death death to give the scoreline a suitably convincing look. The questions for Ireland now come thick and fast. France, meanwhile, have sent a message to the rest of the championship, and there's every chance they'll be back here on the final day with a Grand Slam on the line.
As for Ireland, they are left to lick their wounds. Here is a frank assessment of their performance last night from their captain, Caelan Doris.
Left ourselves too tall a mountain to climb in the first half. Lacking a bit of bite, definitely. Some class from them, but not good enough from us. We didn't shut them down early enough. We allowed them to play some of their flowing, attacking rugby. Not good enough from us in the collision. Our kick chase let us down connections-wise. Some grit and determination in the second half. Good impact from our bench, but very disappointing overall.
The opening round of the Six Nations first weekend continues tomorrow in Rome with Italy against Scotland, followed by England hosting Wales, although wing Emmanuel Feyenoord-Bosu is now an injury doubt for England's opener at Twickenham after pulling out of training early yesterday with a leg injury. In football, Leicester City have been docked 6 points by the EFL for breaching financial rules. The deduction is applied immediately, meaning the club fall to 20th in the Championship, only outside the relegation zone on goal difference. More from BBC Radio Leicester commentator Owen Palmer-Atkin.
This goes back to profit and sustainability rules in the three-year reporting period up to the end of the 2024 season. So that was the season that Leicester City won the championship under Enzo Maresca and were promoted back to the Premier League. In that season, they had a loss of £19 million, but before that, it was much, much higher, closer to £90 million in the season they were relegated from the Premier League.
Tennis and Great Britain lead Norway 2-0 in their Davis Cup qualifier after wins for Cameron Norrie and Jack Draper on his return to the sport yesterday. Day two starts with the doubles at 3 p.m. this afternoon. And in cricket, England Test captain Ben Stokes suffered a facial injury after being hit by a ball whilst coaching Durham's academy yesterday. It's understood he was struck by a ball as he stood beside the nets. The severity of his injuries is unclear, although if you do look at Ben Stokes' Instagram, I believe we call that a shiner, don't we? A real pearler. He's posted a picture of himself with this awful black eye on his right eye with some cotton wool shoved up his nose to stem the bleeding. That he's been in the war, certainly.
Ouch. Thank you, Mike.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Time now, 28 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London and Lisa Costello with the news.
The United States and Iran are due to hold direct talks for the first time in 8 months as Washington seeks to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Trump has repeatedly threatened military action if there's no diplomatic solution. Iran has said it's willing to discuss the nuclear issue, but not additional demands. Sir Keir Starmer, his ministers and advisers will be forced to disclose all communications with Lord Mandelson before and after his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee has said WhatsApp messages and emails dating back to Labour's election victory in 2024 will be included. The Prime Minister is under pressure after acknowledging he knew Lord Mandelson continued his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein even after the American financier's conviction for sex offences. A review has suggested that the cholesterol-lowering drug statins are far safer than previously thought. The study in The Lancet looked at trials involving more than 120,000 people. The results suggest statins don't cause the majority of the possible side effects listed in PACs, including memory loss, depression and sleep disturbance. The Democratic Republic of Congo has agreed to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants from the UK. The British government had said it would stop granting visas to people from the DRC unless there was cooperation. Namibia and Angola face the possibility of similar restrictions but agreed to cooperate in December. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has insisted she will do what it takes to secure the UK's borders. A teacher who was injured at a school in southwest Wales has been discharged from hospital. Police were called to Milford Haven Comprehensive School in Pembrokeshire yesterday. A 15-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. The Winter Olympics opening ceremony takes place this evening. The event is being split across two locations in northern Italy. The San Siro Stadium in Milan will host performances from Mariah Carey and Andrea Bocelli, while another Olympic cauldron will be lit in the resort of Cortina in the Dolomites.
Thank you for that. It is 26 minutes to seven. Keir Starmer is still Prime Minister, but at the end of a week that has been bruising, to put it mildly. Harry Farley, political correspondent, is on the line. And it's not over for him, is it, Harry?
It's not. And I think we can fairly say that this has been the worst week for Sir Keir Starmer as Prime Minister. And at the end of it, that body of opinion among Labour MPs that think it's now a question of when, not if, he is forced to step down has widened and it has deepened. And that matters because it makes it much harder for him to turn it around and convince his MPs that he's the right person to lead the party. On that question of when, there are different opinions within Labour MPs. Some say after that by-election in Gorton in a few weeks' time, that's only become more important this week. Some say after the local elections in May, but it could be later, even months later. And the one comparison from recent history, Theresa May lost her majority and the confidence of many Tory MPs after that 2017 general election, and yet she stayed on as Prime Minister for 2 years to come. So this is this could last for many months yet to come. And one fact remains in Sir Keir Starmer's favour at the end of this week, and that's that Labour MPs cannot agree on how to replace him, and more importantly, cannot agree on who.
Yeah, I mean, we got a picture of that yesterday. We talked to a Labour MP at 10 past seven yesterday. It was really open about the difficulty that there would be in the case of the party deciding to replace him. And that looms very large, doesn't it? It seems in the minds of a lot of Labour MPs who are not at the moment calling for him to go for that reason.
Absolutely. And there is, I suppose, first the question of process, the difficulty in the Labour Party process of replacing a leader and a Prime Minister. You would need 20% of Labour MPs to put their names publicly forward in support of another candidate. So that means in this case, 80 MPs. And then there are the question of the candidates themselves. You know, one name that is frequently mentioned, Angela Rayner. People close to her tell me that she's frustrated by how long it is taking to resolve those tax affairs that led to her resignation. They're still ongoing. It's not also entirely clear whether she would want to stand. Andy Burnham, another name that frequently comes up, of course, blocked from standing as an MP. Shabana Mahmood, highly thought of by some within the party, but not clear if she could command that enough that of support. And finally, Wes Streeting, of course, known to be close to Peter Mandelson. And I think we should mention, you know, some MPs I've been speaking to question whether now that all these communications, all these messages, all these WhatsApps between Peter Mandelson and officials and government ministers will be published, there are questions about whether they could contain embarrassing revelations. We should say that all those named deny plotting to replace Keir Starmer, but they are the names that Labour MPs talk openly about.
An important thing to say, Harry. People can believe it or not. It is their choice. Harry Farley, thank you.
It's 23 minutes to seven. Talks between the US and Iran will start in Oman this morning. Hugo Beshega, our Middle East correspondent, is following developments from Beirut. Hugo, before we get into what they will and won't talk about today, just remind us how we got here.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are seeing these talks as perhaps the last opportunity to avert a military confrontation between the US and Iran, because there's been a massive American military build-up in the region, and President Trump has threatened to attack Iran if there isn't a deal. And this build-up came in response to the brutal crackdown by the Iranian authorities on those anti-government demonstrations that happened in the country last month. So I think today, for the Iranians, obviously, the talks are key to prevent an attack. And for President Trump, depending on the outcome of the talks today, this could be an off-ramp from his military threats. There is a lot of concern from countries here that an American attack could lead to chaos in Iran, to a wider conflict, because Iran has threatened to attack American military assets in the region, to attack Israel. We could also see its regional proxies joining Iran in a possible response. So it is a very important moment in this crisis, and I think the hope here is that we could see a de-escalation of tensions, but this would require significant concessions from both sides, and we don't know if they are prepared or willing to do that.
Yeah, because Iran has said, we will talk about nuclear, but we won't talk about our ballistic missiles, we won't talk about proxy groups, we won't talk about protesters necessarily. But the US will want to do that, so they're going to have to agree somewhere in the middle, potentially.
Yeah, this is very interesting because it really shows the huge gap between the positions of the Iranians and the Americans. And again, you know, for these talks to be successful, they will have to concede. So the Iranians are saying that, you know, these talks will be focused on its nuclear program. The Americans were saying, look, we also need to discuss Iran's ballistic missiles program, Iran's support for proxies in the region like Hamas, like Hezbollah here in Lebanon. And the Iranians say that, you know, this is unacceptable, a breach of the country's sovereignty. And don't forget, there is deep mistrust here. The Iranians were engaged in negotiations, nuclear negotiations with the Americans last year. Those talks collapsed when Iran launched its surprise attack on Iran last June. So many Iranians are concerned that despite these diplomatic efforts, President Trump may still decide to attack the country.
Hugo Bashega in Beirut, thank you.
20 to 7 is the time. There are reports in the US that the arms control treaty known as New START that came to an end yesterday might still be observed by the US and Russia. We heard some fears yesterday on the programme that the end of the New START arms control treaty would mean a new nuclear arms race because the major powers would not be able to verify each other's behaviour. Not necessarily true, say other experts, including Joseph Rogers of the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C.
I think the situation is quite a bit more complicated. I think China and Russia have both been expanding the size of their nuclear arsenals for quite some time. And the New START treaty actually isn't verifying much because the on-site inspections under the treaty haven't resumed since the COVID pandemic of 2020. So while I do think we are entering a more dangerous world, I don't know that New START is the sort of linchpin for a new era.
The fact is this morning that it looks as if it might, though, be observed for a period of time. Is that a good thing?
I think there's a little bit of back and forth about whether or not there is agreement to extend the central limits of the New START Treaty. Just yesterday, there was negotiations reportedly between Kushner and Witkoff and the Russians to possibly extend the limits. But then Trump posted on Truth Social that the U.S. was not interested in extending the limits. And so I think that we're coming down on the side of not extending the limits. But at the end of the day, I think a 6-month extension, whether we do it or we don't do it, it might be helpful because it might buy us 6 months. But really what we need is to negotiate something that more accurately reflects the world of 2026.
And what is that thing? Give us the outlines of what you think would be the safest treaty that could replace it, and indeed the possibilities that such a treaty could now come into play.
As I mentioned, New START was negotiated in 2010. And since 2010, Russia has fielded a wide range of systems that circumvent the treaty, that aren't included in the treaty. They've been developing Poseidon, an underwater drone with a nuclear warhead on it, Kinjal, a nuclear-powered cruise missile. They've fielded several systems that are not New START treaty accountable. And so what we really need is a follow-on treaty that is much more comprehensive in nature and includes the wide range of systems that have been developed over the last 16 years.
Chances of getting that?
You know, as for the potential for negotiations, I think that this could either go one of two ways. Either a world without New START galvanizes more political effort to solve this problem, or we continue to push for including China in trilateral negotiations and China doesn't show up. I mean, I think we're much more likely to get a follow-on agreement if the U.S. pushes for arms control negotiations with Russia and gets rid of the requirement that China engages in trilateral arms control.
Do you think Donald Trump, and crucially, I suppose, those who advise him, are up for that?
I certainly think that if the United States puts its mind behind and gets its nuclear experts behind negotiating a follow-on treaty, we could. And I think it's also really important that a new treaty that enters into the political environment of 2026 is rebranded. The New START Treaty was negotiated by the Obama administration, and I think there's political value to having a new arms control treaty negotiated by a Republican Party in 2026 that might be more long-lasting.
Joseph Rogers, thank you very much for talking to us. And that brings us to 17 minutes to 7. There were some heartfelt personal experiences yesterday in Parliament as MPs discussed the government's 10-year cancer plan for England, not least from the Health Minister himself, who said she hoped it would turn cancer from being one of the country's biggest killers to a treatable condition for 3 out of 4 patients. Susan Hume reports.
While the maelstrom rages around the Epstein files and Peter Mandelson, other parts of life go on, even at Westminster, including making sure life does go on.
A cancer diagnosis changes you forever.
The Health Minister, Ashley Dalton.
When I was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer 18 months ago, I didn't know if I'd be alive today. Never mind standing at this dispatch box announcing a national cancer plan. Yeah. But 1 year ago, almost to the day, the Prime Minister asked me to do just that.
The UK has one of the worst cancer mortality rates among similar countries, despite previous campaigns to improve outcomes. So in what ways did the minister reckon this 10-year cancer plan for England would make a difference?
We will start people's care earlier using liquid biopsy tests, which can turn results up to 2 weeks faster than conventional testing. We will harness AI to read scans, plan radiotherapy, and identify the right path for each patient. We'll harness genomics so every eligible patient will have access to precision medicine.
The Conservative Shadow Health Secretary, Stuart Andrew, thought it sounded good, but then plans often did on paper.
Strong on aspiration, but light on the detail about how change will actually be delivered on the ground. So my first question is simple. When will the government publish clear, funded milestones showing how and when patients will see improvements in the next year or two?
Ashley Dalton assured him the government had started work even before publishing the plan and listed money, staff and equipment that was being put towards the effort already. More than half of us in the UK will be diagnosed with cancer at some point in our lifetimes. So it was no surprise that many MPs had personal or family experiences to recount. Labour's Clive Betts appreciated the intention to have a named person to coordinate people's treatment.
When I had my cancer treatment 8 years ago, I thought I knew my way around the NHS, but it's a completely confusing organisation for anyone involved in it. But one of the things that really helped me was having a specialist nurse appointed at the beginning.
The nurse made sure he could access his chemotherapy around the parliamentary week. Ashley Dalton said she knew exactly what it was like trying to navigate the NHS.
I have in my FIO fax, I'm that retro, about 38 emails and phone numbers of the various people I have to contact in order to personally project manage my treatment. We're going further and making sure that the NHS app can handle all of that information and cancer patients will have it in their hand, in their pocket.
Certainly, Labour's Josh Fenton-Glynn felt the administrative burden on patients now was too much. His brother Alex died last year, and while he paid tribute to the doctors and nurses who treated him...
I think it's fair to say that sometimes with cancer at the moment, you get treatment, but you don't get care. And actually, one of the things that's most exciting about this plan is the section on getting cancer treatment to fit around people's lives. Because Alex spent too long waiting for letters, too long having to be his own advocate, his own professional patient.
Meanwhile, another Labour MP, Ben Goldsborough, who's just in his 30s, had been counting the days.
388 days ago, the words were uttered to me, "You have stage 2C skin cancer." That's 388 days of scans, operations and treatments that didn't need to happen because preventative care could have stopped me from getting skin cancer.
And he said it meant a lot to him personally that the government was taking skin cancer seriously to ensure young people and adults knew how to stay safe in the sun. A Lib Dem, Will Forster, is a supporter of the breast cancer charity Walk the Walk. Fundraising involves things like power walks and night walks, all in a fancy bra. Will Forster had an invitation for Ashley Dalton's colleague, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting.
To join me on the walk in his favourite bra, with me in my favourite bra, so we can raise awareness for mammogram testing, as well as will she ensure that mammogram testing is extended to the under 40s and the over 70s?
Minister. Well, sometimes we often quite look forward to getting to this dispatch box and making promises for our colleagues.
So she said she'd encourage Wes Streeting to take up the offer, and she looked forward to the photographs.
12:07 is the time.
A special version, a simpler version than usual, adapted for babies, because the composers played a key role in a new study which has suggested that babies are born with the ability to predict rhythm. It was quite the experiment, this one. 49 sleeping newborns played pieces of music by Bach, and then versions in which the melody, the rhythm, was disrupted. And when it changed unexpectedly, then the baby's brains reacted. Roberta Bianco is one of the authors behind the study, based at the Italian Institute of Technology in Rome, and her research looks at music and neuroscience. Roberta, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me what you were hoping to, or what you thought you might discover from this.
Well, the idea that stands behind the study comes from me and my co-author, Dr. November, and it's based on the idea that music is not just a cultural product, but a capacity that is biologically grounded. The fact that music exists in every culture and throughout human history raised this important question that we wanted to answer, that is, are we naturally predisposed to perceive music, or do we learn it through exposure? And so to address this, we collaborated with a baby lab in Budapest to test newborns. That is a population in which musical exposure is minimal compared to any other later stage of development.
And when we sort of described the rhythm changing, was it that you took the works and mixed them up? Or was it that they sort of didn't sound melodic anymore? How did you do it?
So actually, we played as main condition original melodies composed by Bach. And as we might have the intuition that music is not fully predictable. So original music is not just a sequence of sound, but contains some structures in terms of rhythm and melody that sometimes are, you know, expected and sometimes are a bit surprising. And this is something intrinsic in the music. So we use computational models to estimate this surprise that each note carries in a piece based on the most probable rhythmic and melodic patterns within that piece. And then we also had a control condition.
And even though these were newborn babies, even though they didn't have much exposure to music, and even though they were asleep, their brains, it's extraordinary, their brains still reacted to it.
That's right. And we believe this is a sort of the evidence that timing and predictability is a sort of inherent trait of our brain. We are exposed to biological rhythm already in the womb. Imagine the heartbeat of the mom or the walking of the mom. And also being aware of rhythmic variations in the environment is something that is important, not just for music, but, you know, in general for survival. So detecting changes in, for example, footstep behind me, you know, might be important because signals that someone is following me. So in a way, music might have emerged from auditory functions that evolved for survival in all animals. And so they may be shared, you know, across species.
And it's fascinating as well that, you know, while we all clearly have rhythm, as the study suggests, some of us develop it better than others. Some of us become very good with it, and some of us can never quite crack having rhythm.
Well, so I guess, you know, basic timing abilities is something that we may all have. But of course, there is a gradient of these capacities across individuals. And with exposure and training, we might become much better at tracking rhythmic patterns. But yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very polite and diplomatic answer. I like that one a lot. Roberta Bianco, thank you very much for joining us, one of the authors behind that study.
7:07 is the time. Statins are good for you. They do not have the side effects sometimes talked about. At least they don't normally. That is the message from a new study published in The Lancet. Professor Brian Williams is the Chief Scientific and Medical Officer for the British Heart Foundation.
These drugs are hugely effective. And my message really for patients is, be reassured,
the side effects that have often been attributed to statins, that's all over social media. This has now been shown not to be true. We recognize there are a small group of side effects, but we can monitor for those, and they're incredibly infrequent and unlikely to affect you.
Let us talk live to Christina Reith, who is Associate Professor at Oxford Population Health and was the lead author for this study. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What did you discover?
So what we found was that the vast majority of medical issues that are listed as potential side effects in statin packaging do not actually have a causal link with statins. So this includes seeing no increase in problems like memory loss, depression, sleep disturbance, erectile dysfunction, nausea, headache, and many, many more. And this is really reassuring, because this really gives us confidence to see that the benefits of statins in significantly reducing heart attacks and strokes, which are serious, potentially devastating conditions, that these benefits substantially outweigh any risks.
I mean, the risk, I suppose, is that someone reads that stuff. And I remember I've been on statins for a decade more, actually. And I can remember originally thinking that I did have some of the side effects. And then actually, as time went by, thinking, you know what, I don't think I do, really. I mean, aching legs were one of the things I was told about when I was first put on them. In other words, the risk is that people read this stuff in the package and then believe that they've got these things, or that these things that they have got are linked to the statins, and they're not.
Indeed. I mean, you have to weigh up the risk of not taking them versus these very small risks we've identified. And I agree with you, when patients look at leaflets, it can be quite alarming. It's a wonder in many ways people do take things. But what I think this is shown is that actually the majority of those things aren't happening. Of course, people may develop some symptoms while they're in statins, because these things go on all the time. But what we've been able to do robustly with our data set is really work out how much more common, if at all more common, these things are. And as I said, the vast majority of things listed in statin leaflets actually are not increased by them.
So we need to change the leaflets, don't we?
Well, I think this should open up a discussion with regulators and indeed other sources of health information to make it clearer what the sources of evidence are, and to help patients and doctors going forwards to make more informed decisions. So, yes, we hope this brings about some change in how the information on statins is presented to you know, assist people in making those choices.
And we heard Brian Williams there, Professor Brian Williams, saying these things are life-saving. I mean, anything we can do to encourage people who ought to be taking them to take them is presumably a very good thing.
Indeed, lots of people have been reluctant to start taking statins or stop taking them because they've been concerned or confused. And we really hope our research adds clarity to that. I mean, I don't see my job as to tell people to take statins or not. I see it as to help produce the most reliable evidence. And I really hope our study, which is the most robust to date, will enable people to do that and make those choices, because statins really do reduce heart attacks and strokes, which I said can be devastating if you have them, if they don't kill you outright. And I really hope this helps people make those choices going forwards and make better informed decisions.
Yeah, and then, as you say, it's not your job to tell people to take statins, but those who want people to take statins, I mean, I know cardiologists who are frustrated, actually. I mean, one who says, in fact, all men, basically over 55 or so, should be on them. There's no harm attached to them, as you've outlined with your study. But in other words, does this open the door now, do you think, for medical professionals, if they want to say that to people, to be able to?
Absolutely. I think what our research will do will give people the tools to outline to patients what the risks are. And we know they're very small and compared to these benefits of statins, which are very widely known. And about 7 to 8 million people are currently on statins, but it's thought many more are eligible. And we hope this will enable cardiologists and doctors and GPs who have a very tough, busy job to have these conversations with patients and give them a clear idea of what the balance of benefits and risks are.
Christina Reith, Associate Professor at the Oxford Population Health Organisation, lead author of that study. Thank you very much.
7:03. Let's take a look ahead to Tuesday afternoon.
I'm Christopher Eccleston, an actor, writer and performer, and I'm investigating the sharp fall in drama education in English schools.
There's been a 48% decline in drama A-level entries since 2010. That's ridiculous. It's halved. The GCSE, it's halved.
I'm finding out how this has happened and why it matters.
It's more than just like something you do in school. It's sort of helped me shape who I am today.
Drama in Schools, an unfolding tragedy. on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Tuesday afternoon at 4.
Talking of unfolding tragedies, the weather from Helen Willetts. Morning again, Helen.
Oh, morning again, Justin. Yes, it's more of the same. We're not alone either. State of emergency declared in Portugal. Yet another storm heading in there. So they're all heading across the UK or down across Iberia at the moment. And they're slow moving. So that's the issue that we have at the moment. Just incessant rain, really. So for England and Wales, it is just wet across many areas and misty, murky over the hills with rain on and off throughout the day. It is brightening from the south. We might see a little bit of sunshine, southern Wales, southern England, but there'll be plenty of heavy showers as well. The odd rumble of thunder, just not the persistent rain. Not quite as windy in the south as yesterday and a little milder, 9 to 12 here, but under the rain further north, probably 7 or 8. Not as much snowfall over the higher ground of northern England today because it's getting a little milder. But for Northern Ireland, more driving rain on almost gale-force winds around the Irish sea coast. So rain on and off here, about 5 or 6. For Scotland, we're in the colder air still. So still some wintriness in those showers across central and eastern areas. But western areas, again, as recent days, may get away with mostly dry and quite sunny weather. May start off sunny in Shetland as well. But the cloud is pushing its way northwards into southern Scotland later. Highs between 2 and 8.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster. Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 6th of February. The headlines today, the US and Iran are due to hold talks about Tehran's nuclear programme, with Washington still refusing to rule out military action. A review of statins has found that they don't cause most of the potential side effects listed on the packaging. And 3 African countries have agreed to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants after the UK threatened to impose visa restrictions.
Plus, coming up in the next hour, he is back.
Who is this creature with terrible claws and terrible teeth in his terrible jaws? He has knobbly knees and turned out toes and a poisonous water at the end of his nose.
It's been 2 decades since we last heard from the Gruffalo, but the great Julia Donaldson and Axel Scheffler will be joining us live to reveal the name of their new book. The BBC News read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Talks between the United States and Iran are due to take place this morning for the first time in 8 months as Washington seeks to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Trump has repeatedly threatened Iran with military action if there's no diplomatic solution. The meeting in Oman is being attended by the US Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff and the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. Here's our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Hawley.
It's taken days of difficult and delicate diplomacy to get this to happen at all. There was wrangling over the venue and format of the talks, let alone the substance. They're the first between the US and Iran since last June, before American fighter jets joined Israel in bombing the country's nuclear facilities. And they come after Donald Trump ordered a significant military build-up in the Middle East, following Iran's crackdown on protests last month, when thousands of people were killed. The stakes are high not just for Iran, but the whole region, with several Middle Eastern countries involved in trying to calm tensions and avoid a new war. But distrust between the two sides is huge, as are the differences between them. Iran wants to focus only on curbing its nuclear program in return for a lifting of sanctions. But the US also wants limits on Tehran's ballistic missiles and for it to stop supporting militant groups around the Middle East.
Ministers, officials and advisers will be forced to hand over electronic communications exchanged with Lord Mandelson, such as WhatsApp messages and emails, as part of the disclosure of evidence relating to his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the United States. Downing Street had hoped to control the process, but was forced to change its plans in the face of anger from Labour MPs. Sir Keir Starmer is under pressure after acknowledging he'd known Lord Mandelson had continued to be friends with Jeffrey Epstein, even after the American financier had been convicted of sex offences. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Number 10 will be relieved that only a handful of backbenchers have publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. But the underlying anger among Labour MPs towards Sir Keir Starmer is still palpable. He's promised to release files related to Lord Mandelson's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US in December 2024. Any documents the government deems potentially unfit for the public eye will go to Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee for further scrutiny. That committee has said it expects the government to provide all documents within scope of that process, which would include personal exchanges between government figures and Peter Mandelson, stretching back to Labour's election victory. Sir Keir insists the files will prove that Lord Mandelson lied as part of that process. But if the documents published cause any further embarrassment for the government over what was known about Lord Mandelson and Epstein's relationship, it would likely lead to yet another difficult moment in which Labour MPs consider publicly voicing their anger.
One of the survivors of Epstein's abuse, Marina Lacerda, told Newsnight she welcomed yesterday's apology from the Prime Minister for appointing Lord Mandelson.
I have to commend him for going, you know, on national television and admitting that he was wrong and apologizing to us. I think that's a huge step, right? You have also people here in America that have not even tried to apologize to us. So I have to commend him for that.
A review of statins suggests they're far safer than previously thought. The study, reported in The Lancet, found the cholesterol-lowering drugs didn't cause most of the possible side effects listed inside the packs. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
Up to 8 million people in the UK take statins. The cheap daily pills can lower bad cholesterol levels to cut the risk of heart attacks and strokes. Like with any medication, there can be side effects. 66 are listed on leaflets in packs, but experts who carried out the study involving more than 120,000 people found only a few rare ones, such as muscle problems. Statins were not to blame for ailments like memory loss, depression, disturbed sleep, weight gain, or impotence. Reports of these adverse effects were almost identical in the placebo group that was not on the medicine. The researchers say the leaflets should be changed to reflect this and avoid scaring people off using the life-saving medicine. And if you do have any problems with your medication, you should talk to your doctor.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has become the latest African country to agree to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants after the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, threatened to impose visa restrictions on people travelling to the UK. Angola and Namibia agreed in December to take back their citizens. Amelia Clark reports.
In late December, the Home Secretary imposed visa restrictions on people entering the UK from the Democratic Republic of Congo after its government refused to allow the return of illegal migrants and offenders. Shabana Mahmood said fast-track visas would no longer apply to people from the DRC, while VIPs and politicians would no longer get preferential treatment as long as it failed to cooperate. Angola and Namibia, two other African nations threatened with visa bans, agreed to the measures just before the new year. More than 3,000 illegal migrants from Angola, Namibia and the DRC could be removed. It's understood that India, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Somalia and Gabon are all resistant to similar returns deals. It's possible that the government could look at sanctions for those countries.
The Home Office says nearly 60,000 illegal migrants and convicted criminals have been removed or deported from the UK since the general election in 2024. It says 15,000 were removed, a 45% increase on the previous 19-month period, and 43,000 left voluntarily after being told they were in the UK illegally. A number of people have told the BBC they face growing debt after inheriting retirement flats they can't sell. They say restrictive leases and high running costs are putting off potential buyers. Angus Crawford reports.
The investigation found private leasehold flats built for the elderly standing empty across England and Wales. One housing expert believes there may be 10,000 of them. High management costs, oversupply and restrictive leases all cited as possible causes. Service charges, ground rent and council tax still have to be paid, as much as £11,000 a year. A woman who inherited a flat from her late mother told us it had become a financial noose around her neck. Another described it as a nightmare. The industry says it's not immune to a general market downturn and that it does support families trying to resell. But we found flats that had been on the market for more than 8 years. One relative faced debts of up to £60,000 and others say they now want to give the property away.
A teacher who was attacked at a school in Pembrokeshire yesterday has been discharged from hospital. A 15-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder after the incident at Milford Haven Comprehensive School. Police say he's still in custody. The Winter Olympics will formally open this evening in Italy. There'll be two ceremonies in Milan and the resort of Cortina in the Dolomites. Most of the indoor competitions, such as figure skating and ice hockey, will be hosted in Milan, while alpine skiing will be in Cortina. Snowboarding and freestyle skiing will take place in Livigno in the Italian Alps, from where our sports correspondent Andy Swiss reports.
For the first time in Olympic history, the opening ceremony is being shared across two locations. The main event in Milan will feature performances from Mariah Carey and Andrea Bocelli, but at the same time there'll be another ceremony and another Olympic cauldron in the mountains in Cortina, reflecting the geographical spread of these games across northern Italy. For Team GB, who won just two medals at the last Winter Olympics in Beijing, there are high hopes. They have a number of current world champions, including skier Zoe Atkin and Matt Weston in the skeleton. Britain have never won more than five medals at a single Winter Games, and with a target range here of between four and eight medals, they'll be hoping to beat that tally.
Andy Swiss reporting.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven is the time. This is an agonising time for people who want the government to be governing, particularly for those who voted Labour for stability and calm, and indeed those Labour MPs who came to the Commons in 2024 wanting to deliver progress. Simon Ofer was one of them. The Labour MP for Stroud was a family doctor before becoming an MP, and he's on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin.
What do you think needs to happen in Downing Street now?
Well, I think, I mean, there's a lot, as you said in the news, there's a lot of anger amongst Labour MPs because really we want to, I mean, yesterday I wanted to be talking about the cancer care plan, not about Peter Mandelson. So I think what we need to do, I think what needs to really happen is that we need to, Keir Starmer needs to change his advisors in number 10. I think he's being badly advised and he's been really let down, particularly on this decision. I mean, I know in politics we really rely on people to sort of cover our backs, our advisors. And I think they patently haven't done this with Peter Mandelson, and I think so we need a bit of a clear out really.
Right, so 10. So that would mean Morgan McSweeney, his chief of staff, would go.
I think so, yes. I think as a chief of staff, I think if my chief of staff had done this, I think he'd be looking for another job, to be honest. So I do think we need a change. And I also really think we need to investigate exactly what was known about this. So, you know, on Wednesday, for example, many of us went to our whip saying we can't vote for the government amendment as it stood. And so I was delighted in the end that the Intelligence and Scrutiny Committee is going to look at everything in a balanced and non-partisan way.
Isn't the problem with your solution, though, getting rid of Morgan McSweeney, and you're not alone in wanting to do that on the Labour back benches, isn't the problem with that that Keir Starmer himself, if he's going to lance the boil, as it were, has got to take some of the responsibility himself for the decision that was, in the end, a decision that he made to send Peter Mandelson to Washington, and that nothing else really will do?
Well, I think, you know, we need to know what the details were and how much they did know. We know, you know, what they knew. And I think, I mean,
Just on that, though, sorry to interrupt, but just on that. I mean, it was known that Peter Mandelson had been a friend of Jeffrey Epstein. It had also been widely reported that he'd stayed in Jeffrey Epstein's house in New York while Epstein was in jail. There were also warnings, for instance, from Maurice Glassman, the Labour peer who'd been at the inauguration, who reported back to Number 10 that people there were concerned. So there were plenty of warnings there. Isn't it simply a fact that Sir Keir chose not to heed those warnings?
Well, I can't answer for him, and I don't know what Peter Mandelson said to him, etc. I think that, you know, we'll have to consider that. But I do think that on the face of it, really, he's been very poorly advised. And I think that, you know, Peter Mandelson was brought into the government and was consulted widely. In fact, I was invited to go and see him in 2022, and I'd just become a candidate. He's not someone that I think he's one of the worst parts of the Blair administration, and I didn't really understand why he was being brought back in. But no, to answer that, I think Keir may have things to answer, but I think mainly he's been very poorly advised. And, you know, at the time of the appointment, many, even Tory MPs, like or ex-Tory MPs like Michael Gove, thought it was a good appointment, etc. But we'll have to know exactly what Keir knew and what the advisers knew. So I think, you know, time will tell, but I think that we can say definitely he's been poorly advised. So we do need a real change there. And I think that's what Labour MPs really want. We want a fresh new start around this and get on with the day-to-day, you know, things of actually improving the country, which is really what we've all been here for. And I'm really particularly as a GP wanting to improve the NHS, and we're being prevented from doing this by this type of procedure and gossip.
Could you have a fresh new start with another leader? I mean, is there anyone that you think could take over in the event that Sir Keir decides to step down?
Yeah, there are leaders around. I don't think this is a question at the moment of leadership, to be honest. I think this is a question of getting number 10 properly functioning, actually. And I think if we can do that, I think Labour MPs will be much happier with that. You know, I think Keir is delivering on many manifesto things. He's not great at communicating, but I do think that at the moment it's not a question of changing leadership. But we'll need to see what happens with the investigation.
Simon Ofer, Labour MP for Stroud. Thank you.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Key talks between the US and Iran to try to see off a potential American military strike that's been heavily trailed by President Trump are beginning in Oman. There have been disagreements about the location of the meeting and about what will be on the agenda, with the Iranian regime wanting to focus those discussions only on its nuclear program and not on things like its ballistic missiles cache or its support for proxies in the region. Now, it has been just a month since Iran's security forces brutally and violently repressed widespread protests inside Iran. The Human Rights Activists News Agency is a Washington-based group. They said they've confirmed at least 6,883 deaths, but warned that the number could be far higher. Well, Parham Kobadi joins us, senior correspondent for BBC Persian. Parham, good morning. We've struggled, haven't we, since the regime blocked access to the internet right before that killing began, to know for sure what is going on inside the country. But what has happened in these intervening few weeks?
So as the internet connection has improved slightly over the past few days and over the past week, we are seeing more and more images coming out of Iran, especially from those two nights that were the most crowded and where the mass killing took place, 8th and 9th of January. So we are still receiving loads of videos, and they are horrific. They are horrific, and they are the videos that traumatized the entire nation. It has shocked many people. So we see more and more dead bodies, morgues filled up, piles of corpses on top of each other. And that has created a traumatic experience for many Iranians. At the same time, we see, for example, yesterday, there are footages that we see a vehicle, an armored vehicle, running over protesters. We see other footages that security force on a motorcycle is just randomly shooting, you know, passersbys. So the videos are horrifying. The videos are horrifying. And like I said, when I talk to people in Iran, everybody is saying that there is this sheer sadness among people. People are extremely sad, and nobody's feeling well. And it's a kind of collective national sense of trauma that Iranians are experiencing inside Iran and abroad.
Yeah, as you say, it's had a devastating impact on Iranians. What about on the regime? What has the protests and the US position on that done to them?
So it has definitely, Iranian position has become weakened overseas and inside the country. And they know it. They know it. But they try, for example, on Iranian TV, they try to show that they're still strong. They're still holding their position. But they know it pretty well, because in the past year, Iranian, you know, proxies, Iranian, the groups, militia groups that Iran supports in the region, from Hezbollah to Hamas and other groups in Iraq, have been weakened. And inside the country, this was the most violent crackdown in the history of the Islamic Republic in over the 5 decades. And that has definitely tarnished its legitimacy, of the legitimacy of the government and this regime. And they know it pretty well.
Parham, just briefly, what will the Iranian regime see as success in these talks? Presumably not an attack by the US, but what do they want to try and come away with?
I think the Iranian regime right now is on a survival mode. So they just want, they see everything as an existential threat and they want to survive. That's their main goal, both from within and from outside, because they know that last time when during the Iran-Israel war, what is known now as the 12-day war, they knew that they were grateful to Iranian people that they didn't take it to the street as Israelis wanted to, because they knew that that could overthrow the government. And they said that we are thankful to Iranian people, but we don't, now that Iranians went on the street and now that the United States is threatening to strike Iran, they know that if these two coincide, a foreign attack plus if people go on the streets at the same time, that would be the most existential threat for the Iranian regime that they have faced over the past 5 decades.
Parham Khorbadi, senior correspondent for BBC Persian, thank you for joining us.
18 minutes past seven. Banks could end up paying out more compensation than they initially expected to as part of the redress scheme for missold car loans. Will is back with more on that.
Morning again, Justin. Yes, this is after the regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, suggested at the back end of last year that payouts from lenders could cost as much as £11 billion. It led to a number of the banks, including Lloyds, and just this week Santander, to announce they were setting aside more cash to settle these claims. And many now fear it could put in question whether those payouts begin at all this year. Ian Plummer is with us. Ian's the Chief Customer Officer at the online car marketplace Auto Trader. Ian, morning.
Good morning.
And I guess, is that that latter part, is that the worry for you guys at Auto Trader and across the industry, that this could continue to drag on this year?
Well, the dragging on is definitely a source of concern for anybody in the finance industry. It's equally a concern for the retailers that provide the finance to consumers. And I'd say latterly, of course, for consumers, it should be a concern. Right now, fortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. Consumers are continuing to use finance to buy their cars. 9 in 10 buy a new car on finance. Roughly half of people buy a used car on finance. So as things continue today, for the consumers, it's good news.
Right, so you're not...
I think the key is keeping that balance going forward.
I was going to say, because Santander are talking about that balance, aren't they, and saying that, criticising the FCA earlier this week, saying that they think the FCA is actually going too far in this scheme. Are you seeing that bleed over yet at all into confidence people have in these products and questioning whether, you know, what they're getting, I guess?
No, and I think that's one of the key points I'd like to make, because I think we've seen since this whole issue has come to the fore after the Court of Appeal decisions more than a year ago, that actually the principle of informed consent, which has been very well applied by the industry since then, has led to a tiny handful of consumers actually pushing back on any finance commission that was very clearly declared to them by the retailer offering that finance. We've not seen any change in interactions on our marketplace, where we have 2 million finance calculations acted on by consumers on our platform every month. And that hasn't changed, that hasn't dipped. So actually today, as things stand, consumers are getting a transparent journey, which they're enjoying.
Your share price has had a rough start to the year and the back end of last year as well, then. So what is the backdrop to that?
Well, there's some concerns in the wider marketplace. I think that there is a dampening of consumer demand for automotive. That's clearly not what we're seeing. The market last year was up 3.5% for new cars. It started the year very well, up around 6% in retail for new cars in January. In used cars last year, we saw a market up equally a couple of percent. The final numbers are about due out. So the consumer demand for car buying is still there. There are concerns that consumer confidence is dampening it, but we're not seeing that at all just now.
Ian, thank you for your time this morning. Ian Plummer there, Chief Customer Officer at Auto Trader.
Thank you, Will. It's 21 minutes past seven. A $50,000 reward has been promised for information on the suspected abduction of the mum of US TV anchor Savannah Guthrie. Nancy Guthrie, who's 84, went missing from her home in Arizona in the early hours of Sunday morning, and blood that was found on the porch of her home has now been identified as being hers. Well, Savannah Guthrie, who presents NBC's flagship Today show, issued a tearful plea along with her family for whoever was holding Nancy to get in touch.
Our mom is our heart and our home. She is 84 years old. Her health, her heart is fragile. She lives in constant pain. She is without any medicine. She needs it to survive. She needs it not to suffer. We too have heard the reports about a ransom letter in the media. As a family, we are doing everything that we can. We are ready to talk.
Well, Ashley Holden is a reporter at ABC 15 Phoenix in Arizona. Ashley, thank you for joining us. Savannah Guthrie she's one of the most recognisable faces on US TV, and so people around the country are following this case very carefully. What have law enforcement said about any leads that they might have?
Well, right now, what we have been told is that they still don't have a suspect or a person of interest in this case. And right now, we are going into day 6 of this search. And there was a big press conference that happened on Thursday. And there were so many questions that remained because there's been a ton of online speculation. But hearing that there are no suspects or persons of interest, of course, everyone hoping for leads and hoping to bring Nancy Guthrie, Savannah's mom, home. Really, Savannah Guthrie, obviously, as you said, known all over the United States, but she's also known very well here in Tucson, where this search is playing out. This was her home, and it is also where she worked in local news as well. So there are so many people here in the community that are praying, that are coming together and hoping to support the Guthrie family. I do want to let you know, you mentioned that blood. We have been out here in Tucson, at the home of Nancy Guthrie. We saw that blood out on the front steps of her home. Everyone was also wondering, is there going to be camera footage from inside Nancy Guthrie's home that could help give law enforcement a lead? And we were told that they don't believe that they're going to be able to have any camera footage because Nancy Guthrie did not have a subscription to her service, despite having some cameras in her home. We also had noticed that there was a mount where it looked like a doorbell camera had once been. Law enforcement laid out a new timeline during the press conference, and they said that actually around 1:47 a.m., and this was on February 1st, that doorbell camera disconnected. Now, we asked if they believe that camera was taken, and we were only told that they don't know where it is, they don't have it, and they haven't located it yet. So many questions remain, and one of those has to do with this alleged ransom note that has been sent out to local media as well as a national media outlet here in the United States. A deadline that was claimed in that ransom note has already passed according to our time zone here in the U.S. So many people watching and waiting. And we actually got another video from the Guthrie family pleading for communication, pleading for proof of life, and hoping to talk to this alleged unknown abductor.
Ashley Holden from ABC 15 in Arizona. Thanks for bringing us the latest there.
And that brings us to 26 minutes past seven and to the sport with Mike.
Thank you, Justin. Holders France got the defence of their Six Nations campaign underway with an emphatic bonus point win over Ireland last night. They won 36-14 at the Stade de France. Next up, Scotland play Italy in Rome tomorrow lunchtime. That is followed by England hosting Wales at Twickenham. We now, though, are going to talk about the most watched annual sporting event in the world. Yes, it is, of course, the Super Bowl, which takes place this Sunday in San Francisco. A global TV audience of over 200 million people will watch the New England Patriots take on the Seattle Seahawks. But we thought we'd get a British perspective on this uniquely American sporting event. Efe Abada is a former British NFL player who had stints at 6 different NFL franchises. But as you'll hear, his journey into American football was far from straightforward. But he started by telling me just how much of a cultural event the Super Bowl is in America.
It's one of the only sporting events that I think can stop the world, and globally, millions and millions of people are going to tune in. It's just a great unifier right now. You've got two teams out of 32 teams that have been competing all season long. These are the cream of the crop, the best athletes in the sport.
How do you gauge
British interest in the NFL. It is two decades almost since the first NFL London game. Over those 20 years, how has the sport established itself over here, do you think?
Well, even yesterday, I went to Little Elan Primary School where these kids are playing flag football. It's ingrained in the culture now that you got 9, 8, 10 year olds knowing exactly what position they played, knowing what teams to support and who their vested interest is in the Super Bowl. It's unheard of. It's growing and it's massive.
Speaking as you have about the massive impact the NFL has had here in the UK and its popularity, particularly amongst young people, should we perhaps have expected to see more British stars like yourself make a success out in the States?
That's the aim. You know, Christian Wade and Lewis Rees Hammond, they took a leap of faith and I commend them for going out there. It's a very transferable skills, especially from rugby into the game. It's a very steep learning curve, especially if you're making that transition in the pro leagues. But there's ways that people can take advantage and get involved.
Do you ever wonder and take stock and think what your life might have been without American football? Because for those who don't know, you did have a very challenging childhood coming over here on your own with your sister at the age of 10, I think
10,
it was,
yes.
From the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And what followed was several years in foster care and the social care system.
Mm-hmm.
Is it too much to say that American football and the NFL was your salvation, that it saved
you? No, I say that all the time. I think this game, this sport changed my life. You know, it saved my life and it gave me the opportunity to provide and to be of value. It's given me so much, you know, and that's why in my situation now, like in the platform that I have, I use my voice, I use my story, I use my finances and everything to be able to go back into my communities and try and create opportunities for kids that are still in my situations. Or the sport saved my life and I owe it everything.
It's transformational.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know the foster care system and kids in foster care is something that's not really spoken about. That sector is definitely overlooked. But sports as a in general is instrumental, and I think in all children's lives and all of our lives, because it teaches us all the lessons, all the valuable lessons that we can apply in anything. Discipline, accountability, how to take loss, you know, hard work, planning, teamwork, leadership. It's what's molded me into the man that I am today. You know, it challenged me in so many different ways. So I'm able to use that to interact with these kids and teach them and get them through the door. And then through that, we can assess what their actual needs are, or even just something is giving them a safe place. Because for me, playing American football wasn't this thing that I thought was going to change my life or I was going to become a pro. It was just an outlet for the lack of progression and frustration that I had in my life at the time. And that just led to so much more than I could have ever dreamt of.
Effie Abada, many thanks for joining us here on the program.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The inspiring story of F.A. Abada. Fantastic to meet him earlier this week. And you can follow the Super Bowl 60 this Sunday, Seattle against New England on 5 Live from 11:30 p.m.
Mike, thank you.
Ski cutting through snow at breathtaking speed. Snowboard spinning in ways never seen before. Skeleton sleds pushing the limits. Making history, breaking records, and taking home gold. Trails will blaze. The Winter Olympics starts tonight, live across the BBC.
The weather today will be mostly cloudy with the now inevitable, it seems, outbreaks of rain pushing north and east, falling as snow as well over the Pennines and the Grampians.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Salford, Justin Webb in London, and at 29 minutes to 8, the news from Lisa Costello.
Talks between the United States and Iran are due to take place in Oman this morning as Washington seeks to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Trump has repeatedly threatened Iran with military action if there's no diplomatic solution. Iran has said it's willing to discuss the nuclear issue, but not additional demands. Sir Keir Starmer and his ministers and advisers will be forced to disclose all communications with Lord Mandelson before and after his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee has said WhatsApp messages and emails dating back to Labour's election victory in 2024 will be included. The Prime Minister is under pressure after acknowledging he knew Lord Mandelson continued his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein even after the American financier's conviction for sex offences. A review of the cholesterol-lowering drug statins has suggested they're far safer than previously thought. The study in The Lancet looked at trials involving more than 120,000 people. The results suggest statins don't cause the majority of the possible side effects listed in PACs, including depression, sleep disturbance and memory loss. The Democratic Republic of Congo has agreed to take back illegal migrants and foreign offenders from the UK. The British government had said it would stop granting visas to people from the DRC unless there was cooperation. Angola and Namibia agreed in December to take back their citizens. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has insisted she'll secure the UK's borders. A teacher who was attacked at a school in Pembrokeshire yesterday has been discharged from hospital. A 15-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. He remains in custody. The Winter Olympics opening ceremony takes place this evening. The event is being split across two locations in northern Italy. The San Siro Stadium in Milan will host performances from Mariah Carey and Andrea Bocelli, while another Olympic cauldron will be lit in the resort of Cortina in the Dolomites.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 27 minutes to 8. Creating sexually explicit deepfake images without someone's consent will become illegal today. This issue, you'll remember, really took hold a couple of months ago when people discovered that Grok, the AI element of the X website, could alter images of adults and children to remove their clothes just by being asked to do it. That is now being investigated by the Information and Commissioner's Office. Campaigners say that this new law will help make things better, but that there are elements of it that just don't go far enough. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. First, let's speak to Jodie, not her real name, to protect her identity. Jodie's a survivor of non-consensual sexually explicit deepfakes, and she's campaigned on the issue ever since. Jodie, good morning.
Good morning.
We talked there about the thing which has brought this to people's attention, which is photos on X. But actually, it's much wider than that. It can be, as happened to you, things like creating sexually explicit videos, putting somebody's face into a pornographic video without their knowledge or consent. What happened in your case?
Yeah, I think, as you say, this can be done in an array of different ways. And I think that that's why this law coming in today is so important. In my case, my best friend asked someone else to create a sexually explicit image and video of me on a kind of a pornographic sharing site. I'd never heard of it. It wasn't a mainstream site. I assume it's domiciled outside of the UK, although I'm not sure. And so I think that we need to see this in the context of a much wider issue of, yes, of course, this has been happening on X as part of the kind of Grok situation. And that's a really important piece of the puzzle. But actually, there are these communities of men who are sharing, creating these images, which is much kind of deeper ingrained into our society and is a much, in my opinion, more prevalent issue because it's so hidden as well.
Yeah, this will thankfully never happen to hopefully the wide majority of people who listen to this. But what are the emotions like, Jodie, when you learn for the first time and you see something that has been made of you but is not you and is so deeply personal and violating?
I mean, the point around this couldn't happen to anyone, and I really hope that it doesn't, but the reality is that this probably will happen to a lot of people, and unfortunately most people won't know that it has happened to them. In my case, I did find out because someone had seen the images and they'd sent them to me. But I do think that's a really important point. This really can happen to anyone. Anybody can do this, and for any reason as well. I think that the moment when I saw the images and videos of myself, I really just felt like my whole world had kind of fallen apart, to be honest. It was around 5 years ago, so it does feel like there has been enough time that has passed that I can really start to kind of process those emotions. But yeah, I just completely broke down, and it broke my heart when I realised who had asked those images to be created as well, because he was such a close friend. And, you know, from my kind of long-standing friendship with him, he also appeared to be a women's, you know, rights advocate, and he really cared about women and his female friends. And so I think it's all of those other things that come with it. And often these images are created because someone knows, you know, that person, whether it's a partner, a friend, a colleague. And that's what makes it so much more painful.
Yeah. And Rebecca Hitchens, listening to that, head of policy and campaigns at the End Violence Against Women Coalition. Rebecca, as Jodie was describing there, it's an enormously difficult thing for anybody to go through. And while this new law makes it now illegal to create these images, which is one thing dealt with, there are other elements of the problem that are not covered by this.
Yes, definitely. Today is a really welcome and long overdue positive step. And it's thanks to campaigners like Jodie who have fought tooth and nail for years to try and get recognition and proper sort of criminalisation of this issue. But criminalisation is only one small element, sadly. It's not job done today. There needs to be enforcement of this offence. But what really needs to happen is regulation of tech companies. We saw with Grok, this abuse is happening at an industrial scale. And until platforms are forced to prioritise and made to prioritise women's safety and well-being over profit, the problem will continue, no matter how many criminal offences exist.
And one of the elements is that companies are not compelled, as they are in other countries, for example, as they are in the US, they're not compelled to actually take those images down.
No, there's not enough being done on ensuring that platforms actually respond and take images down and that they are removed. So we know that there was around 3 million women, I think, victimised by Grok alone. And that meant that it reached the sort of critical mass of awareness and the government responded. Luckily, thanks to the work of Jodie, they had this offence that was coming through. But that amount of women and girls shouldn't have had to have been harmed. We're asking for 48-hour takedown orders so that abusive images can be removed quickly from websites, platforms and perpetrators' devices. And more and stronger civil redress routes for survivors, because many women don't want to go to the police, but they do desperately want those images gone.
Yeah. Are you confident that the implementation will be right once this is illegal, that enough will be done to actually take action against those who break the law?
Well, there is a question around enforcement in terms of the police's ability to respond, the CPS's sort of confidence and skill base at prosecuting these offences. But I think, and that's something that we will have to see with time when we urge that training and that upskilling. But the focus on individuals will only get so far. Actually, what are Ofcom, the regulator, going to be doing to ensure that tech platforms are not allowing access to these types of tools, these types of nudification tools that are so, so readily available?
Yeah.
So it, for us, always goes back to, okay, what's being done around those tech platforms? How is there meaningful regulation and meaningful accountability for their profiting? Yeah.
Which is a key part of it. Rebecca Hitchin from the End Violence Against Women Coalition. Thank you to Jodie as well for describing her experience. And just to say, a government spokesperson told us on this, we're going after the companies behind these nudification apps, banning them outright so we can stop this abuse at source.
20 to 8 is the time. This is a big morning. There is a new Gruffalo book to be announced, and it is the first for 20 years. Fox, snake, mouse, all back along with the Gruffalo himself. The Gruffalo books, in case you're wondering what I'm talking about, have sold more than 18 million copies and have been translated into 115 languages. We asked some of our younger listeners what they think this new Gruffalo adventure will be about.
My name is Rex. I'm 5 years old. Gruffalo story is going to be about the Gruffalo's baby. They're going to have an adventure to the seaside. Hi.
I'm Daisy and I'm 7. I think it will be called The Gruffalo and His Friends, because he could become friends with all the animals and they're not scared of each other.
There we are. Thanks to Rex and Daisy. Well, Julia Donaldson, the author of the Gruffalo series, is here in the studio. And Axel Scheffler is on the line, the illustrator, of course. Good morning to you both.
Good
Good morning.
Good morning.
Julie Donaldson, is it called the Gruffalo's Friends or that's
no.
Or anything close? No,
it is not. Do you want me to reveal
it? Yes, reveal it.
This is a big moment. It's called Gruffalo Granny.
An idea from what? From where? Where did you get the idea and what?
Well, I've had this idea actually for, best part of 2 decades, but I've just been so busy writing other things. And now, of course, I'm a granny myself. I've got 9 grandchildren, so maybe that's what spurred me on.
And Axel, when Julia came to you with the idea, because it has been a while, hasn't it? I mean, you've been doing other things, obviously a lot of other things, but when she came to you with the idea, were you at all, did you think, well, really, can we do this again?
Yes, I've been saying for over 20 years there won't be a sequel of The Gruffalo, and it taught me never say never. And yeah, it was a complete surprise for me. And yeah, but it's Julia came up with such a wonderful story that I got very excited about it.
And we'll talk about the story in a second, or what Julia cares to reveal about the story. But Axel, just on your style, and people who are familiar with The Gruffalo books will know it is a very particular style that you have. Is it changing at all?
It has changed, but it was surprisingly easy to make it look as if it was in the style of the books I did 25 years ago. It was not a big challenge to recreate the deep dark wood and the characters. It worked.
Right. And Julia, presumably the deep dark wood is still very much part of it. And I don't know, bravery, risk, all the other kind of the ambivalence,
but you
suppose,
say the deep
which
dark
is the
wood,
genius of it.
I mean, you say the deep dark wood, but of course at the end of The Gruffalo he's been scared by the mouse, and in The Gruffalo's Child he warns his daughter never to go into the deep dark wood.
I've forgotten.
Yes, if it's not a spoiler, the deep dark wood does feature in the story.
What is it that changed in you, because you had, it's been what, 20 years or so, why did you decide now? Because it's not as if you're not doing other things. You're doing a lot of other things. Why are we ready for another Gruffalo?
I think it's partly to do with, it's the National Year of Reading. I didn't actually know that was happening, but I had been in touch with the National Literacy Trust, and who do have a lot of campaigns, and they sort of said they'd love to use the Gruffalo as a kind of mascot. And they kind of hinted, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was another book? And, of course, I had been toying with the idea of doing another book. And what actually happened was one of my sons said, Mum, what you should do is just spend about a fortnight really, really trying to write that new story that's kind of semi in your head. And if you can't do it, then that's the whole thing knocked on the head. So I thought that was very good advice. So I sat down and it all did work out.
Julia, as the author, what do you think the appeal is? Why have they been so successful?
I beg your pardon?
As the author, what do you think the appeal has been? Why have they been so successful?
Oh, I think we're the wrong people to ask. I think it's like asking a huntsman what it feels like to be hit with an arrow, really. But I think it's the fact that people, the grown-ups, like the stories as well, I think, because sometimes I know from my own experience you can get a book that your child likes and you just want to sort of put down the back of the radio to...
That's interesting. So it's the layers that at various ages, including right into adulthood, you can appreciate it.
Yeah, and also parents will always say, oh, my 2-year-old knows the story, not just The Gruffalo, but, all of our books, off by heart. I think because of the rhyme, they're quite memorable. Yeah, as I say.
And on that, Axel, that the use of language, how much does that then assist with the job you've got of illustration?
Well, it's not not so. I mean, it's more the content that I need to start my illustrations. But of course, Julia is such a brilliant writer for stories that can be read aloud. But that's not really my business. I mean, I have to do the pictures and try to amuse the readers and keep them entertained.
I suppose my point is that there's a sort of melody to these books.
Yeah.
And that, I just wonder whether that does then feed through into the way you approach it as an illustrator.
Well, the way the text is written helps us to, so the editor and the art director, to structure the book. And our books are often in this kind of similar scheme. And Julia is very good at structuring a story. So that helps doing the pictures. But yes, the sound or the melody of the rhyme doesn't really affect my illustrations.
How important is it to you, Julia, that these books take people, it's a both a literal and a sort of metaphorical journey into the deep, dark wood, that there is that journey part of it is so central to the success of them?
Gosh, no, I don't. Well, I'm not thinking about metaphors when I write. I want to just write a satisfying story, not too predictable, and with a good sort of chorus line or refrain. So I'm thinking about the language and the storyline, and I think anything else, it's kind of subconscious, really.
Axel, were you going to add something there?
No, it's...
Do you both of you, when you approach all of this, do you both of you have children in mind, individual children in mind, Julia? How do you approach, when you write, how do you approach it?
Yeah, I for me, it's just me and the story. I'm not really thinking at all about individual children. And some of the stories end up being older and some younger, and in a way then it's up to the publisher how they market them and who they're for. I mean, I think it's obviously the children are at the back of your mind, so I wouldn't, for instance, rhyme the word meat with effete or something, I might say feet, but not effete. But it's a bit like, say, you're making a cake for a birthday party. Yes, it's for a children's birthday party, but when you're making that cake, you just want it to be the best ever cake there is.
It's a very good way of describing it. Julia Donaldson, pleasure to have you in the studio, and Axel Scheffler as well. Thank you both, and good luck with the book.
I'll tell you what's so wonderful about those books, having read all of them many, many times over years, is that they are so wonderful as an adult to read to your child. So if you've got small children that haven't quite got there yet, or grandchildren, whatever it is, there is something magical about reading those stories and the rhythm and the rhyme and your child just being absolutely transfixed by every word. It's wonderful. It makes you feel very special. So we'll look forward to that new one as well. Now it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Rabbi Charlie Baginski, the co-lead of the Movement for Progressive Judaism.
Good morning. When we talk about justice, we picture punishment, verdicts delivered, sentences pronounced, the drama of a courtroom. We talk less about what justice is for, what kind of life it's meant to make possible. I've been thinking about that because I've just finished jury service. For days I sat with 11 strangers, reminded how fragile justice is, how much it depends on ordinary people listening carefully, trying to hold someone else's story without breaking it. The law up close feels less like marble and more like human breath. That experience drew me back to Rose Helbron, a woman from Liverpool and one of the great figures of British legal history. My own family comes from that same stretch of Liverpool, and I imagine what it meant for girls like my mother to see someone who sounded a little like them taking her seat in the Old Bailey. Her career was marked by remarkable firsts. Among the first women appointed King's Counsel, the first to lead a murder prosecution, the first woman judge at the Old Bailey. By simply being there, she changed who Britain believed could speak with authority. Her most lasting contribution came in the 1970s, when she chaired a committee on the treatment of women reporting rape and sexual assault. It argued that complainants' identities should be protected and their sexual history not used to discredit them. Behind those reforms lay a conviction: justice cannot function if it humiliates the wounded. A system that deters the vulnerable from coming forward manufactures silence. That conviction feels close this week. Recently released court documents in the United States again exposed how wealth and influence enabled the abuse of women and girls, perpetrators and collaborators protected with a vigour the victims could only dream of. Jewish tradition teaches that law exists to guard human dignity, kavod abriot. The Bible warns, do not oppress the stranger, for you know the soul of the stranger. The rabbis understood the stranger as anyone made small by power, anyone whose story can be turned against them. Rose Helbrun's work lived inside that teaching. She understood that a courtroom should be a place where shame changes sides, where those exposed are finally covered and those who abused power stand in the light. Perhaps that is what justice is for, not the last word of a story, but the first breath after a long holding of breath, a fragile piece in which the vulnerable are believed and the rest of us are changed by having listened. Because a society is judged not only by how it punishes the guilty, but how carefully it guards those who risk everything to speak.
That was Thought for the Day with Rabbi Charlie Baginski, co-lead of the Movement for Progressive Judaism. It is 8 minutes to eight.
In the early hours of the 24th of November 2021, a small boat became swamped and capsized while attempting the journey from France to the UK. It was crowded with migrants. A four-week public inquiry has identified 27 men, women and children whose bodies were recovered. Four other people are missing, presumed dead. Here's one of the survivors, Issa Mohammed Omar, giving his testimony. He's speaking here through a translator during the inquiry.
All night I was holding into the what remained of the boat, and in the morning, and I could hear the people screaming and everything. It's something I cannot forget in my mind. I believe if rescue would come quickly, I believe half of those people would be still alive today. Because we have been seen as refugee, and that's the reason why I believe the rescue did not come at all. We feel like we were like an animal.
Well, what the report of the inquiry says is that there was a French naval vessel that was closest to the small boat, didn't respond to the Mayday calls, but they also say HM Coast Guard's response was flawed, including ending the search early when there were still survivors in the water. Let's talk first to Jacob Berkson, who's on the line. He's a shift member at the Alarm Phone, which is a transnational organisation. It provides support for people in distress at Europe's sea borders. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you think the lessons are that ought to be learnt now?
That's a good question. I think that, well, for me, the primary lesson is that this is a political problem and tragedy. The focus on the border force at the time had a big focus, and still do, on preventing the crossings, preventing people reaching the UK. So the whole setup is around deterrence, and we know that deterrence is not effective. It just makes the journeys more and more dangerous, and so people will take bigger and bigger risks, having to take bigger and bigger risks to make the crossing, and that's what's leading to the deaths. These deaths haven't stopped.
What is the alternative then?
Well, the alternative, I think, is to recognise that people have a right to claim asylum. We have juxtaposed border controls. People should be able to claim asylum at the UK border, which is in France, and be given access to the ferries. They have an excellent safety record. I think the last one that went down was 87.
But so if that were to happen and they were turned down, how would you then prevent them still trying to come? Because what they tell us repeatedly is that they would still try to come here.
Well, the asylum claim has to be handled in the UK and decided and make the decision. And then if it is an unsuccessful asylum claim, then the system is that people are removed from the UK.
Well, if they're not removed from France, are they? So someone, suggesting they make the claim in France.
Make the claim in France.
I'm saying to you, if they're turned down, won't they still try to come on the small boat?
I'm not suggesting that the claim should be heard in France. The claim should be heard in the UK. You should be claiming asylum. There's access to the ferries.
Oh, I see. So I misunderstood you. So everyone who makes a claim of asylum can just come to Britain and claim it here?
Yes, that's right.
Right, which would be potentially huge numbers.
Potentially, but people need to flee and have the right to claim asylum.
All right, Jacob Berkson, thank you. Let's turn to Lucy Morton, Professional Officer at the ISU, the Union for Borders, Immigration and Customs, a former General Secretary of that union. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do your colleagues accept that the HM Coast Guard response wasn't right? In particular, one of the things that was drawn attention to is that there was a an idea that perhaps they might be exaggerating the distress they were in?
I think with hindsight, even with hindsight 24 hours later, the response was inadequate because it led to deaths and it should never have done. It was at a time that is very different from where we are now. And don't forget that at the time, 30 in a small boat was a huge number. We'd not seen anything like that. Now we routinely get over 100 in a small boat. And there hasn't been another repetition of this. But certainly the response on that night led to deaths. And that is massively regrettable.
What do you make of that idea we've just heard, which probably is quite widely believed in the community of people who deal with migrants and support migrants here, that actually we should just let them come, bring them across on ferries and deal with it here, and that way you wouldn't have these deaths?
That's very much a political matter, and I know your previous caller said that this was Border Force's focus. That's not true. It's a political focus for which Border Force is the tool that gets used. If we were to enable something in the way in which your previous caller suggests should be done, we would simply end up with a completely unrealistic number, and the cost to the UK taxpayer would be immense. You have to bear in mind that still, even now, the majority of those taking this type of crossing have been in Europe for quite some time, and many have claimed asylum in Europe already and been unsuccessful already. We are simply the next step in that journey for them. But the general principle that if you are fleeing persecution or war, that you should be able to move to the neighbouring safe country and claim asylum, absolutely we would support that.
Lucy Morton, thank you very much, and Jacob Bergson as well. Now, let us turn to Alex Forsyth, because she is standing by, because it is, of course, Friday and it's Any Questions time. Alex.
Hello, good morning. Tonight we are in the town of Leigh-on-Sea, next to Southend in Essex, where we'll hear what people make of all that has happened in Westminster after an extraordinary week in politics. On our panel, we have the Minister for International Development, Baroness Jenny Chapman, the Shadow Transport Secretary, Richard Holden, the Reform UK councillor, Leila Cunningham, and the writer, environmental campaigner and former leader of the Green Party, Caroline Lucas. We'll be live at 8 p.m. Hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Let's get the weather. Here's Helen Willits.
Rain foremost as we go through the day today. The best of the drier, brighter weather, the northwest of Scotland. And it is getting a bit brighter with a few sunny intervals across southern parts of England and southern parts of Wales, but with it some heavy showers. In between, yes, more misty, murky, grey, damp and quite windy weather. Windy for many central and northern areas again today, so accentuating the chill here. Temperatures around 2 over the eastern side of Scotland with some wintry showers, to as high as 10 to 12 on the south coast with that brightness.
Helen, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London.
Good morning. It is 7 o'clock on Friday, the 6th of February. The headlines this morning: the US and Iran are due to hold talks about Tehran's nuclear programme, with Washington refusing to rule out military action. A review of statins has found that they don't cause most of the potential side effects listed on the packaging. And three African countries have agreed to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants after the UK threatened to impose visa restrictions.
I make it 8 o'clock, but I'm not quibbling. I'm just pointing it out.
No, you're right. Of course you are.
And I'm pointing it out because in the next hour, it says here, we're going to have the latest on the Winter Olympics ahead of the evening's opening ceremony. We're going to be talking to the first British woman to compete in both summer and winter Olympics. We'll also be hearing from the artist Andy Goldsworthy on being an outsider in every sense of the word.
Nature as a subject matter was kind of not seen as the right thing for art to be engaged with. Now, obviously, it's changed. It's the only subject.
Whatever the time is, the news is read by Lisa Costello.
Talks between the United States and Iran are due to take place this morning for the first time in 8 months as Washington seeks to curb Tehran's nuclear program. President Trump has repeatedly threatened Iran with military action after the authorities' violent repression of anti-government protests. The meeting in Oman is being attended by the US Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff and the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. Here's our diplomatic correspondent Caroline Hawley.
It's taken days of difficult and delicate diplomacy to get this to happen at all. There was wrangling over the venue and format of the talks, let alone the substance. They're the first between the US and Iran since last June, before American fighter jets joined Israel in bombing the country's nuclear facilities. And they come after Donald Trump ordered a significant military build-up in the Middle East following Iran's crackdown on protests last month when thousands of people were killed. The stakes are high not just for Iran but the whole region, with several Middle Eastern countries involved in trying to calm tensions and avoid a new war. But distrust between the two sides is huge, as are the differences between them. Iran wants to focus only on curbing its nuclear program in return for a lifting of sanctions. But the US also wants limits on Tehran's ballistic missiles and for it to stop supporting militant groups around the Middle East.
Ministers, officials and advisers will be forced to hand over electronic communications exchanged with Lord Mandelson, such as WhatsApp messages and emails, as part of the disclosure of evidence relating to his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the United States. Downing Street had hoped to control the process, but was forced to change its plans in the face of anger from Labour MPs. Sir Keir Starmer is under pressure after acknowledging he'd known Lord Mandelson had continued to be friends with Jeffrey Epstein, even after the American financier had been convicted of sex offences. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Number 10 will be relieved that only a handful of backbenchers have publicly questioned the Prime Minister's position. But the underlying anger among Labour MPs towards Sir Keir Starmer is still palpable. He's promised to release files related to Lord Mandelson's appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US in December 2024. Any documents the government deems potentially unfit for the public eye will go to Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee for further scrutiny. That committee has said it expects the government to provide all documents within scope of that process, which would include personal exchanges between government figures and Peter Mandelson, stretching back to Labour's election victory. Sir Keir insists the files will prove that Lord Mandelson lied as part of that process. But if the documents published cause any further embarrassment for the government over what was known about Lord Mandelson and Epstein's relationship, it would likely lead to yet another difficult moment in which Labour MPs consider publicly voicing their anger.
The Labour MP Simon Ofer told us the Prime Minister should remove his Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney.
Keir Starmer needs to change his advisers in number 10. I think he's been badly advised and he's been really let down, particularly on this decision. I mean, I know in politics we really rely on people to sort of cover our backs, our advisers, and I think they patently haven't done this with Peter Mandelson. And I think so we need a bit of a clear out.
A review of statins suggests they're far safer than previously thought. The study, reported in The Lancet, found the cholesterol-lowering drugs didn't cause most of the possible side effects listed inside the packs. Here's our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
Up to 8 million people in the UK take statins. The cheap daily pills can lower bad cholesterol levels to cut the risk of heart attacks and strokes. Like with any medication, there can be side effects. 66 are listed on leaflets in packs, but experts who carried out the study involving more than 120,000 people found only a few rare ones, such as muscle problems. Statins were not to blame for ailments like memory loss, depression, disturbed sleep, weight gain, or impotence. Reports of these adverse effects were almost identical in the placebo group that was not on the medicine. The researchers say the leaflets should be changed to reflect this and avoid scaring people off using the life-saving medicine. And if you do have any problems with your medication, you should talk to your doctor.
The study's lead author, Professor Christina Reith, told us makers of statins should take the findings on board.
I think they should open up a discussion with regulators and indeed other sources of health information to make it clearer what the sources of evidence are and to help patients and doctors going forwards to make more informed decisions. So, yes, we hope this brings about some change in how the information on statins is presented.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has become the latest African country to agree to take back foreign offenders and illegal migrants after the Home Secretary, Shibanda Mahmood, threatened to impose visa restrictions on people travelling to the UK. Angola and Namibia agreed in December to take back their citizens. Amelia Clark reports.
In late December, the Home Secretary imposed visa restrictions on people entering the UK from the Democratic Republic of Congo after its government refused to allow the return of illegal migrants and offenders. Shibanda Mahmood said fast-track visas would no longer apply to people from the DRC, while VIPs and politicians would no longer get preferential treatment as long as it failed to cooperate. Angola and Namibia, two other African nations threatened with visa bans, agreed to the measures just before the new year. More than 3,000 illegal migrants from Angola, Namibia and the DRC could be removed. It's understood that India, Pakistan, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Somalia and Gabon are all resistant to similar returns deals. It's possible that the government could look at sanctions for those countries.
The Home Office says nearly 60,000 illegal migrants and convicted criminals have been removed or deported from the UK since the general election in 2024. It says 15,000 were removed, a 45% increase on the previous 19-month period, and 43,000 left voluntarily after being told they were in the UK illegally. A number of people have told the BBC they face growing debt after inheriting retirement flats they can't sell. They say restrictive leases and high running costs are putting off potential buyers. Angus Crawford reports.
The investigation found private leasehold flats built for the elderly standing empty across England and Wales. One housing expert believes there may be 10,000 of them. High management costs, oversupply and restrictive leases all cited as possible causes. Service charges, ground rent and council tax still have to be paid, as much as £11,000 a year. A woman who inherited a flat from her late mother told us it had become a financial noose around her neck. Another described it as a nightmare. The industry says it's not immune to a general market downturn and that it does support families trying to resell. But we found flats that had been on the market for more than 8 years. One relative faced debts of up to £60,000, and others say they now want to give the property away.
A Russian general has been shot in an apartment building in Moscow and taken to hospital. Russian investigators say several shots were fired at Vladimir Alexeyev. No details have been given about the attacker. An investigation in China by BBC Eye has uncovered a network of hidden cameras secretly filming people in hotel rooms. The footage, sometimes referred to as a spy cam pornography, is advertised on the encrypted messaging app Telegram. Wan Qing Zhang reports.
Over the course of a year, the BBC infiltrated several Telegram channels that advertise spy cam pornography. The social media and messaging app is banned in China, but it's commonly used for illicit activity. One channel sought access to a website which live-streamed footage from 54 hidden cameras in hotel rooms across the country. The investigation also found 5 other online platforms which had live-streamed footage from more than 120 hotel rooms in China. Producing, selling and distributing pornography is illegal in China. Telegram says it proactively moderates all content and that sharing non-consensual pornography is explicitly forbidden on the platform.
The Winter Olympics opening ceremonies will take place this evening in northern Italy. The main event in Milan will feature performances from Mariah Carey and Andrea Bocelli. Another Olympic cauldron will be lit at the resort of Cortina in the Dolomites. The author Julia Donaldson has revealed the name of the third book in her Gruffalo series. The first two titles, The Gruffalo and The Gruffalo's Child, have sold more than 18 million copies. She told us Gruffalo Granny would be released in September.
I've had this idea actually for, you know, best part of 2 decades, but I've just been so busy writing other things. And now, of course, I'm a granny myself. I've got 9 grandchildren, so maybe that's what spurred me on.
The author, Julia Donaldson.
Thank you, Lisa. It is 8:10. It's almost a month now since thousands of Iranians were brutally massacred by its security forces as they protested on the streets against the oppressive regime that controls the country. Help is on its way, promised the US President Donald Trump then as he moved military assets back to the Middle East, taking up a position of readiness in the Gulf for an imminent attack. But it never came, at least not yet. This week, the president was asked by NBC News if Iran's supreme leader should be worried.
I would say he should be very worried, yeah. He should be. As you know, they're negotiating with us.
I know they are, but the protesters have said, you know, where are the Americans? You promised them we would have their back. Do we still have their back?
Well, we've had their back.
Well, the protesters thought that might mean military support. Instead, a veneer of diplomacy has prevailed with the US and Iran meeting in Oman to discuss the latter's nuclear program, more than 6 months after America bombed it. Iranian leaders say that that topic is all that's on the table today, not its ballistic missiles cache, not its backing of proxies in the region, and not that killing of thousands of demonstrators. Iran is desperate to avoid an American attack. A US military operation to try to force regime change would be disruptive to the whole region, it would be expensive, and crucially, it would have no guarantee of success. So against that delicate backdrop, negotiations have just begun in Oman. But to what end? Well, Lise Doucet, our chief international correspondent, is following developments. Lise, it seems that a lot has happened in a few short weeks. What will both sides consider to be a successful round of talks in Oman?
Well, they're meeting. That in itself is good, but it has to be emphasized that the circumstances are hardly propitious for a successful round. And bear in mind, this is unlikely to be the last round. Trust is below zero. The two sides have very different styles of diplomacy. And both are going into these talks. It's uncertainty as to what exactly is the agenda. As we're saying, Iranians want this to be very much a narrow discussion, a technical discussion only about the nuclear program. They have said they want to go back to where they left with the U.S. voice last June, when, as they were about to go into six rounds, shattered when Israel attacked Iran. What we have been hearing from President Trump, and of course, President Trump does keep changing the details of what he wants, but he's been talking about not just no nuclear weapons, but also limits on Iran's ballistic missile program. There are confirmed reports that Iran has been working on its ballistic missile program, and also an end to its support for proxies partners across the region. But both sides want to avoid a war. Iran certainly doesn't want another blistering attack. The U.S. wants to limit the risk of wider regional chaos. President Trump doesn't want to be dragged into that kind of conflagration in a year in which he's going to be facing the midterms. So they both want success. Will the United States, and there are some signs that it has agreed to do this, to go, it's what's being described as one after one, which means start with the nuclear and possibly move on to other discussions. Iran has scored has achieved what it wanted in terms of the location. There was a lot of discussion that the talks would move to Turkey. For Iran, that's not just a logistical detail. That was about controlling the agenda. It trusts Oman, that Oman won't widen the agenda, and that it will help Iran in keeping these talks not fully direct. Iran still wants indirect talks.
Lise, thank you. Lise Doucet, our chief international correspondent. Sorry, the line was a little unstable in parts there, but worth persisting just to hear what Lise had to say. Now, a little earlier, I spoke to Kirsten Fontenrose. She was senior director for the Gulf at the US National Security Council in the first Trump administration. She's now at the Atlantic Council. And I asked her how meaningful she thinks these talks will be.
The US team can't leave these talks without addressing all of the files they came in to talk about. They can't make it just a nuclear discussion, even though Iran keeps trying to frame it as such. The president has promised more than that since the beginning, and the U.S. position has consistently been that they need to address, yes, nuclear, but also missiles, also proxies, also drone program. And with the president saying after the strikes over the summer that Iran's nuclear program had been crippled, what would he have to gain from only nuclear talks now? He wouldn't waste his negotiators' time with only that. So the U.S. is going to go in with very different expectation than Iran is. Iran is coming in with two sort of dangerous assumptions as well. First, that the president of the U.S. will do almost anything to avoid starting a long war. They've heard him say that. They know it was discussed on the campaign. They're not wrong. He does want to avoid long wars, but he's just staged two operations in the past year that did not start long wars. So he's two for two. If you look at the strikes on Iran in June and you look at the Maduro operation just recently in January. And then second, it looks like Tehran is assuming that they can successfully convince the U.S. to engage in a prolonged negotiation. This is kind of their sweet spot. This is their comfort zone. They do this quite a bit. But the U.S. administration sort of recognizes this as the playbook and recognizes this as the same playbook that was used by Iran in negotiations with the Biden administration, which is not going over well. So not expecting there to be a deal, even though that is, I think, what both parties would like. They would just like them on extremely different terms that do not appear to be reconcilable.
What do you think the president's appetite is for military action? And you touched on it there. He doesn't want a long war, but he's not averse to the idea of a short strike. And everything is in place. The carrier strike group is back in place in the Middle East. He can do this, but it will be expensive. It won't necessarily gain him any ground domestically with US voters. Do you think this is something that he wants to do?
I agree. The US voters are, frankly, barely paying attention outside of very specific demographics. And he's getting different advice on the domestic situation from different pieces of his domestic advisory group, and then also from his international counterparts, who were saying, you've got a legacy to think about, what do you want your legacy to be? And two sides arguing it can't be getting us into long wars, and another one saying Iran's weakened and it's an existential threat, and if you let it stand and embolden the regime, you're going to be looking at 40 plus more years of the same treatment. You know, so two different legacy framings as well. And then for Americans, we've got midterm elections coming up. So congressional midterms will take place in November. And obviously, that doesn't mean that President Trump has to worry about a re-election as a second term president. But generally, the sitting president loses quite a bit of his hold during the midterm elections, which then makes the second half of that presidency a little more difficult. You know, the U.S. likes to talk about this as a checks and balance. If a party loses a little bit in the midterms, there's a little more balance. But in general, he's told the American public there will be no Iranian nuclear program. And then he told them there is no longer one after our June strikes. So he's really under no pressure to prove anything else to American voters about Iran. And what they don't want is to see more money spent there or to see their sons and daughters deployed and something to support an effort there.
It's also interesting to note as well, isn't it, that what provoked this particular specific period of animosity was the protests in Iran and the killing by the regime of thousands of protesters. That was what, on this particular occasion, drew President Trump in. But actually, that, even though he keeps mentioning it on social media, that's fallen by the wayside. As you say, it may not even be on the slate for these talks at all.
It may not be, not as long as military action is being threatened. And I think one of the things you're seeing is that the administration is assessing the protests and kind of doing the math on what strike action would do to help them or potentially harm them. And that is feeding into the decisions. The protests were suppressed pretty quickly. They were suppressed violently and across the country, which shows that there's a cohesion remaining among security services and leadership. And the administration is paying attention to that. We've also seen statements by reform politicians in Iran arguing that the regime should respond to some of the grievances protests are raising, but we're not seeing the regime respond to that or make changes, whereas in previous eras of protests, they have. They've made changes to hijab laws and the like. We haven't seen any defections from top levels of the security services, even at the height of the protests. So what this tells the U.S. administration is that decapitating the regime would require not just sort of removing the head, but, you know, chopping off the whole bust. You can't just cut down the tree. You must rip out all trace of its roots. And this is a complex task, means a lot more planning, a lot more firepower, much more complex operations. There's so much to think about, and it becomes much more than just targeted strikes in a capital. It becomes, kind of a hunt and chase effort to find out who in each of these organizations, the Ministry of Internal Affairs and Security, the IRGC, the Besiege, what about the traditional military, the Artesh, you know, how many layers down do you have to go before you can really ensure there would be a full turnover of power? That's a lot to think about and a lot to plan for.
Kirsten Fontenrose, appreciate your insight. Thank you.
Thanks. Anytime.
And that brings us to 21 minutes past eight. Let us turn back to our domestic affairs, dominated, of course, by the Mandelson affair and the fact that Labour MPs seem to be incandescent with rage at the way it's all been handled. Simon Ofer, an MP, the MP for Stroud, telling us an hour ago that Downing Street needed change. Morgan McSweeney, the PM's chief of staff, he suggested should go. Let us talk to Mike Tapp, who is a Home Office minister and is on the line now. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Is there any way in which the Prime Minister himself personally bears responsibility for what's happened?
Well, the Prime Minister has apologised for believing the lies of Peter Manderson and said that he regrets his appointment. He's apologised to the country and importantly to the victims. And I think it's important for me as the minister today representing the government to extend those apologies too. Now, I've spent part of my career at the National Crime Agency where I've met victims of paedophilia. One thing that stays with me was searching the room of a young girl looking for evidence of grooming. So this is something that means a lot to me, and I know it means a lot to the Prime Minister. And Peter Manderson has betrayed the country, and that apology is really important.
Except that he knew perfectly well that he had been friends with this man, with Epstein, and he knew that at the time that he was appointed. It had also been widely reported that Mandelson had stayed in Epstein's home when Epstein was in prison for the kind of offences you've just been talking about. So people can legitimately say, can't they, this is a nonsense, it's cant. It's after something has happened, you are claiming to care about something that actually, by your actions as a government, you plainly don't.
There's certainly legitimate concerns. It was public knowledge that Mandelson knew Epstein, but what wasn't clear was the depth of that relationship. And during the vetting process, there were concerns raised, but these were put to Mandelson, and he repeatedly lied, he weaselled, and he tricked his way to, tricking the Prime Minister into that position.
So the Prime Minister was tricked. Well, look, on that point, this is where Harriet Harman comes in and tells a Sky News podcast, he's got to stop blaming Mandelson, saying he lied to me. And this is what Harriet Harman says, because actually he should never have been considering him in the first place. And to say he lies to me make it look weak, makes him look weak and naive and gullible. That's true, isn't it?
Well, no. And this is why Keir Starmer has apologised. For me, look...
What, for being weak and naive and gullible?
No, for believing the lies. Well, that is the same thing, isn't it?
Well,
Harriet Harman is absolutely entitled to her opinion. I disagree with that, and I'll put my opinion across, that it's important for government and for leadership to own mistakes. Mistakes do happen, but it's about how you respond to them. And he's acted on this.
But his only... Sorry to interrupt, hang on a second. Just to answer this point. You say that he's owned his mistake. I'm not sure a lot of people listening will understand that from what he said yesterday. Well, what he said yesterday was that he apologised to the victims, but he also says he was hoodwinked by Mandelson. And what Harriet Harman and others are saying is the business of being hoodwinked makes him a useless leader.
Look, we've got to remember here that the victims are at the heart of this. So let's please, you know, ensure that that's at the forefront of our minds.
Yeah, Keir Starmer keep saying that, but I made the point that actually the victims weren't at the forefront of this when you appointed them.
I know. Look, I have to say I'm a bit frustrated because I don't have much time to talk to you, and I'd like to get my answers across.
Okay, take as much time as you like.
Keir Starmer has apologised to the victims. He's apologised to the country. And what we're waiting on now is that transparency, which is, by the way, what we expect from our leaders. That's what we're getting from Keir Starmer. All of the facts will be laid out. We will also see, I expect, vetting, and people can come to their judgment then. It's important to acknowledge that he has apologised to the victims. I saw victims speaking last night on BBC Newsnight, I think it was, who were very grateful for that. And let's keep them at the forefront of our minds, and let's be patient and wait for these files to come out so that we can make our own judgment.
Are you confident that Morgan McSweeney will stay as his chief of staff?
Look, I mean, these aren't decisions for myself, but I will say that Morgan has been extremely important to the Labour Party from helping Keir turn it round pre-election. And we're starting to see stability come to our economic system so that people can start feeling the impact of this government as we go through 2026. So I'm confident in the Prime Minister. I'm confident in Morgan McSweeney that they will deliver and continue to deliver for the country.
And just a thought about what we should be talking about this morning, because it is important. You've got things to say about the business of returning people who are in this country and shouldn't be.
Yes. Look, we made a commitment to the country that we would work hard to restore order and control. Today, we're seeing nearly 60,000 removed and deported. That's the highest in a decade. If you're here illegally, then we will remove you or deport you. And we will ramp this up and continue so that we can restore that order and control. And it's important also to note that there's been a 30% increase in foreign national offenders being removed and deported, which helps keep the public safe. But we will not stop there. There's much more to do.
Mike Tapp, Home Office Minister, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is 26 minutes past eight. Time for the sport. Mike's back.
Anna, thank you. Ireland's rugby players are licking their wounds this morning after a humbling bonus point defeat to holders France in their Six Nations opener last night. 36-14, the final score at the Stade de France. Next up is Scotland's trip to Italy tomorrow lunchtime. That's followed by England hosting Wales at Twickenham. We now, though, are going to talk Winter Olympics because the final preparations are being made before the big curtain up in Milan this evening.
Welcome to the Olympic Winter Games.
Grande Bretagne.
Great Britain.
What an honour for both Yves Muirhead and Dave Ryding competing at their fourth Winter Olympics and the flag bearers for Team GB.
Yes, the opening ceremony for the 2026 Winter Olympics starts this evening at 7 p.m. our time. That was Team GB's entrance at the last Games in Beijing 2022. As you heard, four-time Winter Olympian Yves Muirhead was one of the British flag bearers in that opening ceremony. She went on to win curling gold in China. She's since retired from the sport, but is now back at the Games as chef de mission for Team GB out in Italy. And delighted to say that Yves joins us live on the programme now. Hi, Yves.
Morning.
So how's the mood in camp today as we count down to this opening ceremony? You will know, won't you, that years of planning go into the preparation for an Olympic Games. And here we are. It's almost showtime.
Yeah. Do you know what? The mood is, it's great. It's a real kind of buzz around the village. I guess it kind of flips from kind of preparation mode to go time. And the opening ceremony night is always something really exciting for all the sports. It kind of gets them in the mood to start competing. But not to mention, we have already started competing. We have the curlers there in full action. It's a great kind of buzz around the village. And I'm sure it's going to be a great evening for all.
What is the British medal aim, the objective for what we could win out at these Games?
So we've got a team of 53 competing athletes, and do you know what? It's hard to put a price on a medal, and I guess I know that better than anybody. But we've got a really great team that's got a lot of potential, and I think we've got to remember the jeopardy of winter sports as well, don't we? It comes down to millimeters, milliseconds, and that's what makes it super exciting. So it's very hard to predict, but what I know is all these athletes have put in a lot of work to get to this stage, and I know they're going to do absolutely everything they can when it comes to fighting for medals.
Because that was the claim leveled by some, wasn't it, at GB ahead of the last Games, where they went in and there was a lot of talk of GB winning perhaps 5, 6, even 7 medals, and some claiming that maybe perhaps the team as a whole believed the hype a little bit, and it didn't really materialise, did it? Just 2 medals last time, one of which of course was gold for you in the curling.
Yeah, well, listen, Beijing was slightly different, wasn't it? Obviously, we were COVID, and things were slightly different in the lead up. A lot of nations got to train a lot more than what some nations did with kind of ice and snow on their doorsteps. And unfortunately for us back in Britain, we didn't have that. But these Games we're really looking forward to. I think we've got a lot of kind of experience and youth within the team that gives us a good kind of a variety of athletes out there competing. So this is Games. It's time to go. And super excited for what the next couple of weeks is going to bring.
Is it still Team GB's stated mission to make Great Britain a top 5 Winter Olympic medalling nation by the time of the next Games in 4 years' time?
Well, we're always pushing forward, aren't we? And that's thanks to a lot of UK sport national lottery funding that helps the sports to do that. And we do know that the sports on the circuit year in, year out are successful. We had the most successful winter season last season leading in to this Winter Olympics. And we've seen several medals come in already this winter season. So as a team, we are in a very good spot, and we are definitely an emerging winter nation, that's for sure.
And just briefly, logistically, these Games, as we know, spread over several different venues. How difficult is that, even for you on a personal level, to navigate? How are you going to get to see everyone?
Yeah, it's not easy, I must admit. And a lot of time is spent traveling, but it's worth it. Like, I want to see all the athletes, all the sports if I can. And I guess the way this games has gone, the organizing committee are adapting the games to the territories, which means we are taking the sport to the territories, reusing venues, and which I think is fantastic. But obviously that does come with slight challenges.
Yeah.
But we can. We just have to navigate the snow, the ice, and the roads. And
we'll
make it happen.
If anyone can do it, Eve, I'm sure you can. Are you excited about watching Mariah Carey perform live later?
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait. When I saw that was the announcement, everyone's buzzing for it. I think honestly it's going to be a fantastic ceremony, and I hope everyone tunes in, and that's when the kind of real buzz begins, isn't it?
I wonder if she likes curling, Mariah Carey.
Perhaps
she
could
be a convert during these games. You never know, you might see a rinkside. Eve Muirhead, chef de mission of Team GB at the Milano Cortina Games, which start later this evening. Many thanks for joining us, and of course should say you can watch the opening ceremony on BBC TV and the iPlayer later from 7 p.m.
Mike, thank you. Here now is Lauren Laverne to tell us who's been cast away to the desert island at 9.
My castaway this week is the Astronomer Royal, Professor Michelle Doherty. Her love of the night sky started in childhood when she first looked through the telescope her family built in the garden.
I saw Jupiter and its four large moons, and I saw Saturn and its rings, and I must have been 10 or 11. I thought, oh, this is really cool. That's really out there.
Professor Michelle Doherty, My Castaway. Do join us to hear her Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
The weather today will be mostly cloudy, but do watch out for outbreaks of rain pushing north and east, and they will fall as snow. It's a cold one over the Pennines and the Grampians.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Justin Webb in London. It is 27 minutes to 9, and Lisa Costello has the news.
The United States and Iran are due to hold their first direct talks for 8 months when senior officials meet in Amman this morning. Washington is seeking to curb Tehran's nuclear program and limit its ballistic missiles. President Trump has threatened Iran with military action repeatedly following the crackdown on anti-government protests in the country. Keir Starmer and his ministers and advisers will be forced to disclose all communications with Lord Mandelson before and after his appointment as the UK's ambassador to the US. The Prime Minister is under pressure after acknowledging he knew Lord Mandelson continued his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, even after the American financier's conviction for sex offences. The Home Office Minister, Mike Tapp, told us Lord Mandelson had tricked Keir into giving him the ambassador's position. A review of statins suggests they're far safer than previously thought. The study, reported in The Lancet, found the cholesterol-lowering drugs did not cause most of the possible side effects listed in the packaging.
Thank you, Lisa. Let's get more on the news that a general with what is understood to be a senior role in Russia's military has been shot in Moscow. Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, can tell us more. Steve, I know early days, not a great deal of detail, but what do we know about what has happened and about who this man is?
So the man we're talking about is Lieutenant General Vladimir Alexeyev. He is deputy head of Russian military intelligence, so certainly a senior figure. This is what we know so far. Around 7 o'clock this morning, at an apartment block in the northwest of Moscow, General Alexeyev was shot several times in the back, we believe. The gunman got away. The general was rushed to hospital. As far as we know, he's still alive. He's reported to be in a serious condition. Investigators are on the scene. They're studying CCTV footage. Interviewing witnesses. That's what we know so far.
And this is notable, Steve, because this isn't the first attempted assassination of a high-ranking Russian military official in the last few years.
It's not. I mean, if you go back over the last year or so, several senior Russian military officials have been killed. I remember in December 2024, there was General Kirillov, who headed Russia's military... the Russian military's nuclear, biological and chemical protection force. He was killed in a bomb attack, a bomb hidden in a scooter outside his apartment block. And then just going back to last December, 2025, another Lieutenant General Fanil Salavarov, who was head of the Russian General Staff's Operational Training Department, he was killed in a car bomb. Today's attack was a shooting. We don't know who was behind it. And as I say, the gunman got away, and doctors right now are trying to save the life of Lieutenant General Vladimir Alexeyev.
We'll watch for further details. Steve, thank you. Steve Rosenberg there, our Russia editor.
And that brings us to 24 minutes to nine. Might the government be forced into another U-turn, this time on the subject of student loans? There is a growing backlash against the freezing of the repayment threshold in November's budget, but also more widely about the unfairness of a system that traps some students in an ever-increasing cycle of debt from which, well, really, they'll never escape until the whole thing is eventually paid off and taken up by the government. Meg graduated from university 5 years ago. She tells us she struggles with repaying the loan.
When I left uni in 2021, I'd borrowed 47,000, and now it's what, like 5 years later, and it's gone up to 62. I've been paying it back pretty much every month since I left, because I went straight into work afterwards, and I think now I'm paying about £150 a month. And obviously that's just not even going towards the interest at the moment. So it just feels like that's money coming off my paycheck that's going into this like bottomless pit. It just feels so unfair. And I remember being at school and someone coming around to us and saying, oh, it's the best loan you'll ever get. Like, I mean, the reality is it's just money that's coming off every month that you really need to be spending on other things. You know, look at my paycheck and you just think that £150 that I'm paying, I need on rent, I need on food. It just feels like wasting money.
There's talk to Sir Vince Cable, the former Liberal Democrat MP, of course, but also business secretary during the coalition, who oversaw the 2012 reforms to tuition fees and is here in the studio. Sir Vince, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It doesn't work at the moment, the system, does it?
Well, I think successive governments, including the one I was in, have created a system which is horrendously complicated. Very few people understand it. Numerous loans on different terms. But also it's created a real sense of unfairness. Essentially what's happened now is you've got a squeezed middle. People who graduate with very low incomes or out of work don't pay anything. If you get a very high salary or your parents are well off, you pay off all your obligations in cash. So it's the people in the middle who are being squeezed. The underlying principle is fair and sensible and clear, which is you pay 9p in the pound. It's effectively a graduate tax. But if you pull down the threshold, which is what this government's now doing, more and more people are dragged into the system and they pay more and they pay longer.
What in that case can be done, do you think?
Well, with difficulty, but I think the government really does have to address the issue of the freezing of the threshold. You and I was responsible for the system. We lifted the threshold substantially from, I think, 15 to 21. It would now be in the mid-30s. Freezing it just aggravates the problem of people who are already struggling with high housing costs and problems of this kind. And people are paying marginal tax rates, middle-income people of, you know, well over 50%. So I think lifting the thresholds is crucial. The interest rate system is very difficult for people to understand. And I think simply reducing the interest rate to the basic rate of inflation.
Because the interest rates are high, aren't they, in feel to many people. I mean, it's almost a psychological issue, isn't it? Even if one day it will be paid off, which it will be, there's just this sense that you've got this thing that is growing and growing and growing because of the high interest rates.
Yes, there is a 30-year time horizon. After that point, everything is written off. But the effects of the high interest rates are more psychological. Actually, there's only about a third of graduates who pay the total amount. But nonetheless, it's complicated. It's frightening. And it's unnecessary. It was just a Treasury rule that you have the inflation rate plus 3%, and it's now produced interest rates which are quite forbidding. So I would cut it down to no more than the basic rate of inflation.
Do you think it might become a political thing? Because we know, I mean, goodness, you know, from the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg knows very well how big a thing this can be, how it explodes in people's faces, the whole business of student loans. And you've got Reform saying various things and other parties saying various things, the Greens saying we're not going to have them at all, etc. So however unrealistic any of that might be, that the government does now begin to come under real pressure to change.
Yes, I think where it feeds into a general sense of unfairness is it's about generations. You know, older generations are reasonably well protected. I mean, I'm a pensioner myself, but benefit from the triple lock and things of this kind, which have proved to be quite generous relative to other items of public spending. Whereas the younger generation are not just fighting great difficulties in the housing market.
Is that the nettle to be grasped? Because you said we went to the Department of Education. They say the fiscal situation of this government means we have to make tough choices, threshold freezes, part of a hard but fair decision, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, you're saying, no, you could get rid of the triple lock and you could afford to do this.
Well, it's not a simple trade-off like that, but if you're looking for a fairer system, the triple lock actually was a very progressive thing and did a lot to help reduce pensioner poverty when it was introduced. But it is gold-plated and doesn't need to be gold-plated. But I think we mustn't just fixate on the financing scheme for students. I mean, the whole university system has been very well protected through the years of public finance cuts. They've had plenty of money keeping the system going, and they do need to reform. And we need to get to a system now where they're much more flexible. You should be able to do short, intensive degree courses, then top it up through life with lifelong learning. And that kind of mentality, universities working with colleges, adult colleges, that's currently missing. The universities have become very rigid and inflexible, and they need to reform.
Sir Vince Cable, thank you very much.
It's 18 minutes to nine. There is a new public art prize to fund the creation of free, accessible works across the UK that everybody can visit. And we are revealing it first here on the BBC. It's called the Dent in the Universe Award. And it'll be the largest single source of public art funding in Britain. And we can also tell you the first recipient, Andy Goldsworthy, whose £200,000 award is all going towards the construction of gravestones. It's a project using thousands of stones that have been taken out of the earth when graves were dug. And Andy's hoping that his work will eventually become a place for people to come, to mourn and to celebrate their loved ones. And our culture editor, Katie Razzle, met him on the Scottish Hill in Dumfries and Galloway, where the artwork will be created.
The wind gets up, the rain starts driving, the hills come in and out of the clouds and the fog and the mist. It's very atmospheric.
I'm walking up a hill in Dalveen with Andy Goldsworthy, who's giving me a first look at the location for his newest work. He had the idea for gravestones many years ago, after seeing a pile of stones in a cemetery and realising they'd been displaced for a burial.
As soon as I realised where it had come from, that changed completely that stone for me. It turned it into something incredibly powerful.
He decided to make a 25-metre squared walled enclosure filled with gravestones.
Very stark, very simple. A sea of stones that have been displaced by burials. A sea of humanity.
And does making a work like this make you muse on your own death to come?
Of course. I think it makes it less intimidating. When we're looking into the graves when they dig them, they are quite comforting. You know, in a very strange way. They're very inviting.
The new work is being funded with £200,000 from a new annual public art prize from the Hugo Burge Foundation. Its CEO is Lucy Brown.
Every year, in perpetuity, we'll fund up to a six-figure sum a new piece of public artwork. There used to be a lot of public artworks commissioned as part of kind of civic life, and you would get these amazing works in the 20th century particularly. You know, Hepworth and Moore would be commissioned to make these beautiful works of art, and that's really fallen away.
And why did you choose Andy Goldsworthy?
I mean, it's Andy Goldsworthy. He's amazing. He's one of our greatest British living artists. Everybody knows him. Even if they don't know his name, they know his work.
Goldsworthy's always worked in nature. His Hanging Stones project is a 6-mile trail on the North York Moors. Other works include fleeting leaf sculptures, a huge curling dry stone wall in New York's Hudson Valley, and the vast snowballs.
Roger, I've just come past the big giant snowball in Smithfield Market.
That appeared in midsummer in London back in 2000.
We're amazed, actually, to see a snowball in the city in the summer.
It's like a fossil.
So where are we?
We are in Kirkconnell at the graveyard. Let me see what we can find.
For gravestones, he's working with gravediggers across more than 100 cemeteries in Dumfries and Galloway to collect stones displaced from graves.
Every aspect of this is done with hopefully with a care and a seriousness and a respectfulness. There's not many stones in there.
No, nice clay, but no stones, surprisingly.
Grave digging is no longer spade work. They use small mechanical diggers. At St Michael's Cemetery in Dumfries, I met grave digger Toby Howard.
I take pride in my work. I try and do the highest respect as possible, because at the end of the day, it's somebody's loved one that you're burying.
So what do you feel about the fact that now some of the stone that you've dug up is going to be made into this artwork?
I think it's good, aye. It's repurposing it, really. Kind of like a bit of everybody's grave combined together.
Well, this is granite and whinstone. These are the pebbles.
Back at Dalveen, I asked Andy Goldsworthy whether he cared that for many years he was overlooked, even shunned, by the often urban-oriented art world.
I didn't care, but I knew I was, you know. But for me, it was also a kind of a misunderstanding of the land, too. Nature as a subject matter was kind of not seen as the right thing for art to be engaging with. Now, obviously, it's changed. It's the only subject. I've just done my work, and I've been outside in every respect of the word, and quite happy to be there, to be honest. Because whilst the art world is fantastic, it's a very small world. And I have the privilege to be working in the world. And that's an amazing thing to be doing.
But what does it feel like now to not be on the outside anymore?
I still feel on the outside, you know.
Katie Russell talking to Andy Goldsworthy there. It is 13 minutes to nine. The opening ceremony of the 2026 Winter Olympics is happening in Italy tonight. The events are already underway. So Team GB will be represented in 11 events, things from alpine skiing to snowboarding over the next 2.5 weeks. And Montel Douglas is with me, competed in the bobsleigh in 2022. You were the first British woman to compete in both the summer and the Winter Olympics.
I was, and I'm very greedy.
Why not? Which did you prefer?
Oh, I mean, it's, I'd say summer. It's just very, very different. They're very, very different. But I have a really lovely special appreciation of the Winter Games.
Of both. And so you're heading to Italy. You're going to be part of the team covering it. So what should we be looking out for over the next couple of weeks?
We should be definitely looking at, obviously, our home nation, because we have set a big old target of like 4 to 8 medals, which I think is well within our reach. Definitely the curling's already kicked off in the mixed doubles. And I think that that's very special. We love to watch curling, even if people have no idea what's going on. Trust me, you will be engaged. And
it always
and
captures people, the curling.
It really does, which, like you said, a lot of people understand it, but we really, really tap in, which is lovely. And figure skating is going to be definitely one to watch. We've got a nice British tribute, I would say, with Lila and Lewis in their performance. And I'm biased, but sliding sports are where to go. Definitely bobsleigh, but absolutely the skeleton. We've got a real chance of, I think, some few medals in skeleton, and definitely in Matt Weston in that skeleton in the men's single. So I'm really hoping that that comes to fruition, but it is going to be very engaging to watch.
Those ones, you said that the sliding sports, as you call them there, that
yes.
Always, because there's the sort of the jeopardy and the danger and the nervousness. And also actually somebody in Ashley Nelson, who's competing in Team GB, who like you, mm-hmm. was also a Summer Olympian.
Yes, definitely. Me and Ash go way back. I mean, we've competed against each other. I've coached her. I've been along her with this journey. And now she's going in to do, I think this is her 5th Olympic Games. And this is going to be her first Winter Games, going in the 2 women's bobsleigh, which is really nice. And also alongside my former, also track and field compatriot, Adele Nicole, who she'll be in the back of the sled with, which is really, really funny. And they're both the track and field and now going to bobsleigh. And she's actually also making history as well with the first ever British monobob, which is the single woman's bobsleigh. If people don't understand what monobob, it's one bobsleigh, and which they introduced not long ago, actually, in the last cycle.
And these are all things, it's worth saying, that if you don't know about now, we can learn about, because you and all of your colleagues will be walking us through. It's one of those things, I think, the Winter Olympics, that you can get into quite easily. Yeah. You can have it explained to you. Just remind me how and where people can watch and listen if they want to follow along with it all.
Well, they can actually watch anywhere, anytime, which is amazing. The BBC Sports On Demand content is on BBC Sports website and the app, but also they're uniting us with 450 hours of live coverage. Can you imagine that? Live coverage for the Winter Games on BBC One, Two and iPlayer. And there will be Olympics Extra, which is the live digital stream between 8 and 11 daily. So no matter if you're an early bird or a late night owl, you can come and watch and celebrate in the Winter Games.
There's a lot to enjoy. I always think for people like you, former competitors, it will be brilliant to be there. But I always just think, I was going to say if it were me, I mean, obviously I have not an Olympic bone in my body, but you would just, part of you would think, oh, I wish I was out there on the course doing
it. Honestly, you'd think that, but honestly, no. And this is very full circle for me, you know, being part of the BBC Sport team and being able to provide that coverage, but also a different insight, because how many people get the unique insight of being at the Games? And I was only actually there 4 years ago. So it's very, very recent. I know exactly what they're going through, and hopefully, and now I get to just kind of share in that journey and those stories that we get to see coming out of the Games, because it's not just about performances. It is about being, like, inspirational stories from people that have worked really hard for the last 4 years or possibly even longer, and seeing us perform brilliantly, which I'm really sure that we will do that.
And as you were saying as well, and we heard from Eve Muirhead earlier in the programme, actually, mm-hmm. She was talking to Mike in the Sports Bulletin, and, you know, sights are set high. You know, we're hoping to do well here. We're hoping to get a decent number of medals.
Yeah, and Eve knows exactly what she's talking about, being a multiple medalist herself. You know, I've had the pleasure of competing with, being the same team with Eve, but also going out with her at the Youth Olympic Games, the last Games, and she did with Chef de Mission also. And she set those targets because they're achievable. You know, we've done really well, especially the 2014, 2018 era, and had a blip in 2022. But we always try to improve those things. And I think having a range now as well, rather than a set medal target, is really going to help, I think, the athletes as well take the pressure off of thinking we absolutely have to get those medals. And I actually just think we're going to have some nice surprises there, so you are going to want to watch, because there are people that we've not mentioned that I think will be getting on that podium.
Yeah, there's lots to look forward to, lots to enjoy. You'll be right at the heart of it. Montel Douglas, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Thank you.
8:58 is the time. Let us finish with the Mandelson affair and where it leaves the Prime Minister, and the question, I suppose, of lost control as well. Anne McElvoy is on the line, executive editor of Politico, co-host of the Politics at Sam and Anne's podcast, the better half of that podcast, she would no doubt say, and Lord Barwell as well, Gavin Barwell, who worked as chief of staff to former Prime Minister Theresa May back in the day. Good morning to you both.
I'm going to let that one go, Justin.
tell me this first of all, Gavin Barwell, what's it like? Give us a kind of sense of what it is like when number 10 becomes a bunker.
It's obviously pretty difficult, particularly if you feel that you're kind of on the right side of the issue. In my case with Theresa, the problem was all around one issue, which was how to try and resolve the kind of Brexit impasse in Parliament. And I think there are really only two ways out of it, Justin. You either need a moment where you can kind of reassert authority. So in her case, her opponents moved too quickly against her and there was a sort of confidence vote, and she actually won that confidence vote, and that bought her a few more months when her kind of authority had been reasserted. Or, as happened right at the end, she concluded that actually she couldn't resolve it, she couldn't solve the problem, and the honourable thing to do was to get out of the way and let somebody else have a go.
Can you see any way now that he survives?
I can see a way that he survives, at least for some time, but I can't see very easily the path that takes him from that survival mode, which is just hanging on in there, as Gavin was referring to something that you could call governing or setting your path forward. And politics is always about owning a vision of the future, even if it's the very near future. Yeah, I have something that the country needs me to do, and that's why I have to stay, and it would be disastrous if I went. I mean, I think that is ultimately the argument that now number 10 and its proxies are beginning to try to make. The problem is we've got so many likely adverse events in by-elections and in the May elections coming at them, that sustaining that very narrow path is going to be very tricky indeed, I think.
Because I think one of the things that we were talking to a Labour MP earlier in the programme, who was saying, yes, they wanted to re-seize the initiative and do all the sorts of things that he wants done, but actually the initial step, he said, is get rid of Morgan McSweeney, the Chief of Staff, to get him out of Downing Street. Gavin Barwell, have we passed on beyond the moment when that would be useful to the Prime Minister, do you think?
Well, we don't know that. He might be able to offer up a sacrificial lamb and buy himself some time, but he doesn't sound like he's in a place where he wants to do that. He was very defensive of Morgan when he appeared at the Commons the other day. I think there's two things that are sort of slightly protective of him, which is, one, it's not clear who the successor would be. And that, I think, can sometimes keep a prime minister in place. And then secondly, the Labour Party doesn't have the muscle memory of how to do this. It's not ruthless like the Conservative Party is. They allowed Jeremy Corbyn to lead it into the last, into a general election when it was obvious to pretty much everyone that was going to end badly. So those are the two things that might protect him. But I agree with Anne that the tragedy here is what he promised was an end to all of this psychodrama that marred the last few years of the Conservative government, so that we could actually focus on what the country needs, which is a government that can get our economy growing again and bring back prosperity. And unless he can find a way of getting out of this crisis, he's not going to be able to do what he promised he did. And, you know, the country needs a period of political stability.
And it's worth pointing out, isn't it, Anne? This is not just a one-off crisis. It's a rolling crisis, because there is going to be more stuff coming out now.
Yes, it's going to be crisis as usual for about the next 6 months. I was just sitting down with someone closely involved in this process. I mean, you can't even say involved in the process. The process hasn't really even started yet. But, you know, I was asking roughly what we'd expect. And I think we could be in for about 6 months by the time you take these factors of the information that they will want to come out or not want to come out through the Intelligence and Security Committee. The Scotland Yard element, which of course holds things up because the police really have to have their first go at questioning Peter Mandelson and deciding what they think the remit of that end of the inquiry and any potential crimes are. So then you know, you're already held up. I do think that we're in the right zone when we're saying he can survive, but can he govern? I think that is, to me, a better question than is he going to be there next Thursday? I mean, you know, please have me back if I'm wrong and he's being pushed out. But for the reasons that Gavin states, you do have to, if you come for the king, you better not miss, as the old saying goes. And it's not absolutely clear which of the pretenders to the crown is ready now at this moment to dip their hands in blood against Keir Starmer. I have to say, I felt slightly sorry for him yesterday, you know, going off to do, you know, not particularly on the handling of the Mandelson affair, where I think he's just been extremely naive at best and foolish at worst. But, you know, this is not a bad idea to be going out talking about pride in place in parts of the country and communities, including one actually where I grew up, which would be a beneficiary, where, you know, which this is just now completely not covered in any detail. And that's a sign, isn't it, of how can you continue your line forward when he's admitting himself he's not going to get that message across. But that then becomes the problem. Then why have you got that prime minister?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? You can't escape, can you? And you will know this, Gavin Barwell. A prime minister can't escape from his or her essential personality. And that, in these moments, in a sense, the advice to Keir Starmer is escape from yourself. Be different. And you can't be, just as Theresa May couldn't really be.
No, I mean, I think that the job of a number 10 machine is not to try and change the prime minister. It's to try and make what their strengths are assets for the government, essentially. And the concern, I think, always in the Labour Party about here has been, how much is he actually a politician? How much does he actually have an overall story of what he's trying to do for the country? And I would just come back, Justin, to where I started a few moments ago, which is, the story he told us before the election is that he was going to bring stability and an overriding focus on growth. And actually, what we've got is more of the psychodrama and perma-crisis and not what he promised. And if he can't find a way to put an end to that and get us out of it, then he needs to, I think, draw the logical conclusion that he needs to let someone else have a go. And I'm very worried about some of the material that might now get released that could do